welcome to the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, joined by the CEO. He is Cave Den Online. Daniel Schriever, what's going on, my friend?
Hello, hello, David. Good to see you. Happy BNR.
Yeah, exciting times. Kind of came out of nowhere, but for the Ponder lovers, it's kind of a Christmas Day 2.0.
Ponder is back, baby. We have a whole episode dedicated to Ponder brews. You can play four Ponders now in all your decks. This will, of course, be a vintage-focused episode. So we got some Lotus brews, some Mox brews, some...
Sure.
Take the initiative brews. Who knows? But yeah, somewhat surprising announcement. Violent Outbursts gets the axe in Modern in an effort to reduce the metagame share of Cascade, specifically the Rhinos deck, although they acknowledge this is definitely going to hurt Living End even more. So we'll get into all of that. That also includes a little bit of a format health check on Pioneer. We can see what they have to say about that. Beyond that, a little bit of Magic news just out in the multiverse. We have some new cards to follow up on. We talked about last time some of the previews from Outlaws of Thunder Junction, from Modern Horizons 3, from Bloomborough. We missed a few, David. There's just like so many. A few snuck in. So I was sifting through all the Universes Beyond stuff. There's a few Pioneer legal cards that we did not talk about. We'll cover those today.
Yeah, I mean, when they release like seven different sets, but like six cards from each at the same time with random mechanics and other stuff thrown in, it's not surprising that even we, who are about as heavily invested as you could be, couldn't figure out what set was legal and what format. And oh man, what a mess.
I rely on Mythic Spoiler to gather in one place all the new cards, but you're sifting through there, it's just like so many cards. Fallout Commander decks and all these symbols you never seen before, we'll probably never see again. Yeah, playable cards slip through the cracks, so we'll get to those. And after that, we got some new brews, so we are going to be looking at some of David's latest creations, focused on one of our favorite mechanics, Investigate. Be cracking some clues. Very excited for that. And we may even get a special guest field report a little bit later in the cast.
Yeah, before we get all that, of course, we need to take care of our housekeeping at the top here. We want to welcome our newest patron Thursday Afternoon. Thank you very much. Big welcome to Thursday Afternoon. And just a reminder, if you'd like to support the podcast, the best way to do so is to go to patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. And join at whatever level is comfortable for you.
Yeah, exactly. Patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. That's where you can sign up, and that will get you immediate access to our wonderful Discord community, as well as just a nice way to give back to the show and help us keep the brews coming. So with all that being said, news of the week, David. Talk me through the March 11th BNR update.
Yeah, kind of came out of nowhere. I think on maybe like Friday or Thursday, they announced there was going to be a ban announcement on March 11th. Of course, there wouldn't be an announcement at all, and they wouldn't schedule a Twitch stream if there wasn't going to be something banned or unbanned. So people were, you know, kind of floating stuff around. We are not big Standard players, but from the people who do, it seems like Standard is by far maybe the best format out there right now, and certainly as strong as it's been in a while. Yes, not a lot of new cards show up in Standard because of the extended rotation, but we give Wizards a lot of shit. I think we have to kind of tip the cap too. Like right now, Standard looks awesome. You look at the deck list, the different things you can do. You can play mono red aggro, you can play tempo, you can play mono green ramp, you can play these like salt eye lands, graveyard, teamer lands, graveyard, like combo control. So Standard looked awesome. We were hoping there'd be no bans, there were none. Pioneer, we just had a pro tour. We had a lot of cool decks. We had some technology. You know, obviously the Channel Fireball team or whatever they're called now had a great tournament with Black Red Vampires. People have started to adjust to that. We were expecting no bans in Pioneer. We saw no bans in Pioneer. Modern's been a tire fire basically since Modern Horizons 1 came out. I famously don't even play the format anymore. I don't like being exploited. Yeah, so they've continuously pushed the power creep and just continue to ban cards that are part of Magic's history, Magic's legacy. And this, they probably had to continue to do that. They did indeed have to ban another card from Magic's history. because of new cards that they printed in the Horizon sets, which was Violent Outburst.
So what do you make of this pattern here? The MH2 or MH1 stuff or Lord of the Rings stuff comes out, juices up archetypes. I mean, the MH2 set was specifically designed to beef up this cascade mechanic, right? Putting Shardless Agent in, putting in a whole new cycle of these manaless suspend spells. So they really like want this to be a thing. And what do you know? It's actually like too good. So presumably this was by design, right? They wanted us to play this deck, built it for us, quote unquote, but you know, it just keeps getting upgraded every single set because they keep going into this alternate cost reduction again and again. When that happens, in theory, a format should be able to absorb a deck being too good for a while, right? We all know what we signed up for. The metagame may be imbalanced for a time, and eventually something's got to go. So on the one hand, it's good they're taking action. On the other hand, the card that they ban is the old card. The cards that are deemed problematic are the ancient ones. Here is Violent Outburst, you know, Simeon Spirit Guide, or whatever it is. They want you to play with the new stuff, and you know, just the instant speed Violent Outburst is a problem.
Yeah, I guess there's two ways to think about it, right? If you want to take it from their side, or maybe a less critical side, is that the specific card that they end up banning, Mox Opal, another example you could use, was always overpowered, and it just didn't have the right support around it. And so eventually that was going to be the case. The instant speed on Violent Outburst, the fact that it generically is probably the most powerful of all the effects, right? Orcish Aura Flam for Dan and myself, old people, +1/+0 to all your creatures, is actually the best generic effect of all of them. EOT doing it. It also combines insanely well with a different free card that they printed, Force of Negation, which was not supposed to be able to protect your combo, right? That's why you can only cast it on your opponent's turn. Turned out to be very important with Violent Outburst. Turned out to be very good against sweepers. You get, 8 damage in, et cetera, et cetera. And then, like you say, they're always printing better cards. They changed how Fire Ice casting cost is registered. So now it can not be hit by Cascade anymore. That's big. Now they have 2-mana interaction. They print Leyline Binding. They print Leyline of the Guild Pack. They print Scion of Draco, et cetera. Some of those cards come from Modern Horizon sets. Some of them are just generic cards, right? Leyline Binding is a card that's been very interesting, I think, for standard, but very, you know, powerful with Leyline of the Guild Pack, very powerful with Fetch Tri-Land, which is, you know, a mistake. I don't want to get like pedantic about all these things that I've complained about all over and over again. So I think that's the one way to say it is, look, the Violent Outburst was a problematic card. It was always the most powerful card in like old school versions of this, right? Like Travis Wu top 8ed 2 Grand Prix when this was like a quote-unquote joke deck in a row. Like, this was his baby. It was a challenge to build the deck well then. The deck is pre-built for you now. I mean, you just look at the list. 4 Force of Negation, 4 Subtlety, 4 Fire Ice. They played, the Red Evoke Elemental before it got banned. 4 Leyline, 4 new Leyline. There's no, like, you know, the new cards that fetch lands from Middle Earth, all these cards add to the consistency, right? You can even fetch the new Surveil lands. So, yeah, was it always the most powerful card? Yes. Is it the card that ought to be banned? I don't know what other card you would ban, though. Would you just ban the 2/2? That is kind of the thing that prompted these decks to like become way better in the first place. Shardless Age.
Yeah, that's a fair point, right? If the goal is to just dial back the power slightly on a deck that they want to exist, which is what they say they're doing in this ban announcement, then yeah, you have options. You can go for the instant speed of the Outburst, or you could say, all these things that David just mentioned, push the deck slightly higher. Like Lorien Revealed, that land cycler, turns out to be super important for playing Subtlety and Force of Negation. It just like lets everyone get so greedy with their pitch spells. You could say, okay, maybe that was the problem. I've wanted them to take care of the Triome Fetch problem for a while. They're just never going to do that because it's not considered a problem. If your goal is to make an incremental change, then you could target any of those things, but it would be hard to justify, right? If you want this to be a long-lasting, permanent, quote-unquote permanent fix until you print MH3 in like 2 months, then yeah, I guess it does make sense to target the unique one, the most powerful one. Is, I think that's a fair assessment. The Outburst is the most powerful. it's funny reading their announcement. They recommend buying copies of Ardent Plea and Demonic Dread if you want to keep playing this deck, which people have done. People bought Ardent Plea immediately.
I mean, I think I saw a deck fade in 5-0 already with an updated list. I just...
Yeah, the deck is probably still fine.
And again, we're talking about brewing. It's like a 4-for-4 swap, and then I think he played for Bloodbraid Elf. I mean, this also like doesn't encourage deck building. It's just the same deck. I really hate the cascade mechanic into these free spells. It doesn't reward any type of creativity. Like, everyone's cascade list is exactly the same, like plus or minus a card.
Yeah, fair point.
And it again, when we talk about free spells, like, this is a 3-mana 2/2 that comes with 2 4/4s. So if you're paying 3 mana for anything and you're not getting 10 power, like, what are you doing? What is the point of that? It's just... Like, think of how good you'd have to make a normal 3-mana creature to compete with that. And so people don't play 3-mana creatures in Modern. Right? I mean...
Well, it comes at a heavy deck-building cost, David. You can't play any 1 or 2-mana spells if you want to do this.
It's true. It's absolutely true.
Yeah, I was just tickled to see Demonic Dread get a shout out here. That was a card that I featured in my broken quote unquote Tybalt Cascade deck before they nerfed that interaction. That one glorious week, I refused to play Violent Outburst into my deck because I didn't want to stretch the mana that far.
Were you already playing black?
Well, yeah, I was playing Ardent Plea and Demonic Dread because I didn't think that I could justify playing the Outburst.
Oh, because you want to play red and green. I see. You should.
Anyway, yeah, that's why I didn't win that challenge. That's why I only got top 8. But, all right, so fallout from this particular ban in Modern, not something that we were going to spend a lot of time on specifically. We don't brew that much in Modern. However, friend of the show, Lawson Zandi, texted me yesterday to ask if I was coming to the Hunter Burton this weekend. It was a shocking question. I was like, what do you mean, Lawson? That's like way in the past, that was a year ago. And he's like, yeah, exactly. It happens every year, Dan. Like, it's that time again. I'm like, oh my God, how is it already tied with Hunter Burton? So that's, yeah, apparently this Saturday, it's this a big tournament in Texas that began as like a memorial for player Hunter Burton, who tragically lost his life. But it's become like a really nice event where the entire Texas community gathers. It's competitive. You know, there's a 15K main event and a Pioneer 5K on Sunday. Had a great time last year, so I think I will go this weekend, which now requires me to find both a Modern deck and a Pioneer deck for when I inevitably scrub out of the Modern 15K. So thinking about Modern first, predictions that I've seen are that the format is not going to change that much, like based on the matchup spread of pre-nerf Rhinos. Yawgmoth and Titan were decks that were perhaps being held back by Rhinos. So one could say we'll see more of those decks. I don't know if that line of thinking holds any water.
And so what would you consider to be like the, you know, what, we don't need to get into the tier structure, but like the 5 or 6 archetypes that you expect to be, you know, sort of among the best in the tournament? Those two you just listed. Cascade will still exist.
Yeah, I would say Yawgmoth, Amulet, Murktide, Rakdos Scam, which has survived the Fury ban just fine. Rhinos will probably survive the ban just fine. I think those 5. I would expect... I mean, Domain Zoo has been putting up such strong results lately. I don't know how much of that is just like the cool factor or how represented that deck is going to be.
What about Tron?
I don't have a good read on it. I'm not sure. What do you think?
If you think that the Cascade lists are no longer going to play Force of Negation, I think Tron's in a lot better place. Like, Dak Faden's list does not play Pact main deck anymore. He's got them in the sideboard. But other people have tried to, like, Andrea Mengucci just played the exact same list, just subbed out the 4 for the 4 and played a different tri-land to fetch the white. So if you still have Pact main deck, then Tron is in trouble because the free interaction there just buys you enough time to kill him with Rhinos. If they don't have it, though, then you're in pretty good shape, so... But again, who knows what people are going to do.
When you say Pact, what do you mean?
Oh, sorry. Force of Negation. My apologies.
Oh, okay. I was like, Pact of Negation is a bold strategy. I'm not sure I would do that personally, but...
Force of Negation. Because, yeah, like, Mengucci just replaced the 4-4-4 and has a white lands to fetch for. But, like, Dak Faden's list got rid of the Force of Negation's main deck and played for Bloodbraid Elves. So he was, like, much more aggressive, but doesn't have the interaction that the old Rhino's list had.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Like, a Bant version of Rhino's, and one is just like, no, I'll just make it work. Direct swap, keep the deck the same, fundamentally.
Right.
So just knowing myself, knowing my soul, I'm not going to have time to either buy the cards or learn a new deck in the next 3 days. So,
and we know what that means.
Most likely what that means is it's time to dig out the old Crab Vine cards again. That almost got me to day two last year. We'll probably just run that back. Biggest thing that holds Crab Vine back is Graveyard Hate. And that's a big question mark, because if Yawgmoth is a deck people are afraid of, if Yawgmoth is on the rise, in theory, Graveyard Hate would also be on the rise. If Scam becomes more popular, which is another deck that was somewhat weak to 10 power out of nowhere, then yeah, more Dalthy Voidwalkers is going to be a problem for me. I don't know if there's anything I can do about that. I might just try to get lucky and avoid those matchups. So I spent some time yesterday trying to learn, like, what's the current optimal build of Crabvine? And I realize it's been a while since I wasted your time, dear listeners, with Crabvine content, so allow me to waste a little bit of your time. Cards that we've talked about for the past three sets that may or may not fit into the graveyard strategies. Biggest one is Souls of the Lost. What do you think of this card, David?
I love it. I think it's really good. It's a large creature, which matters. It can be a very fast clock. You often have cards you want to move from your hand to your graveyard. So in some cases, it does not have a downside, right? It's actually like somehow an upside. It also is pretty sweet with Citrus Supplier. Like, you can just, like, your nut draws can exist with Citrus Supplier. Or, I don't know, again, if you're a Myco Tyrant person, it's kind of a sweet card with that as well.
I'm not personally a Myco Tyrant person. I don't know, it just feels like one mana too many. But Souls of the Lost is, like, right in that sweet spot. Two mana, you can kind of talk yourself into it. A lot of the 5-0s with Crab Vine lately, and I'm going to say that confidently as if there's been a lot of these, there's like 3 5-0s, 5 or 10, not many 5-0s, but many of them have 4 copies of Souls of the Lost in what I previously considered like a Rotting Rats flex slot or something like that. It's not a card that does anything when you just mill it, right? It's not a synergy card that way. It's not a card that does anything when Endurance sweeps your graveyard away. It's just a big beater. In that sense, I'm like a little bit nervous about it. Like, I'm not actually sure how good this card is. It's not even like an Urborg Lurgoyf, which provides some card advantage when you can kick that. But I might try Souls of the Lost. I mean, everything David said makes total sense to me. A card I will not play is the Ancient One. I've seen some people trying that. Some people have 5-0, but that seems like a complete blank, right? This is the 8-8 that just doesn't do anything unless you have Descent.
Well, or 4 mana.
Right. Fathomless.
Then it loots.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it looks sweet, but I was much more intrigued by some of the lines that David was envisioning and probably in like a lower power format like Pioneer, where you're just trying to use the 8 power for like your fight rigging or something. So I probably will not play that. Wheel of the Forgotten is one I thought might be a useful sideboard card, although you pointed out that I mistakenly thought it was like a coercion effect. It is not a coercion effect. It's just a balance plus Rotting Rat effect. Yeah, it might just not be good enough for its cost. I've seen some Crabvine lists play like a couple main deck and a couple side. I think a better sideboard card is probably just Pick Your Poison. Card is just too good to pass up right now. And it has so many targets, right? It takes out Saga. The biggest thing it takes out right now is Cyano Draco, which I never thought I'd have to say this, but like if they lead on Guild Pact into Cyano Draco, this Crabvine is completely shut down. It's like a 2-mana Batter Skull. That's just a disaster. The lifelink plus First Strike plus Hexproof is like a complete disaster for any kind of chip damage strategy. So I might just like auto lose game one to a Scion plus Guild Pact, which is kind of sad to say.
Plus, isn't it Vigilant?
It's got Vigilance, it's got Hexproof, it's got Lifelink, it's got all the things. I can't even trade Avengevine for it because it has First Strike. So
yeah,
that's a little bit sad, and that's giving me some pause as I say that out loud. Let's talk about the good news. Good news, cause for hope, is that the Surveil dual lands we're seeing them getting picked up by pretty much every deck in Modern. This is something that, David, you predicted, right? It's such a super strong line. I mean, the difference between looking at your opening seven or opening six or five in Crabvine's case, seeing that one fetch land there and no second land, but like the rest of the hand is like almost there. It's like super powerful. If that fetch land can become a surveil one, like I'm just like so much more confident about that hand. So just like the ability to like have this, just to have more keepable hands, I think is going to automatically make Crabvine much better. That's not even accounting for the synergies of like Crabvine actually uses the surveil in a very real way. So I'm trying to decide if I want to play one or two surveil dual lands. I'm leaning towards two.
The other thing that's sweet about it is it really encourages your worst instincts. Like, man, the sketchy keep is like, I'm exactly. Probably like, if it's sketchy, I should probably, I was like, well, I mean, it's not that sketchy anymore. I'm surveilling one.
Exactly. Exactly.
What could go wrong?
This is exactly it. Yeah. I mean,
what do you play? Do you play 19 lands in a Crabvine list?
I play 20 and I have like an extra.
I play three.
Three out of 20.
I play a swamp, two of the blue-black one, which is something sewers, and maybe like one of the blue-green one.
Three because you want to be able to do it multiple times a game?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Would you consider like cutting a spell for that to go like increase your land count even higher?
Not being a Crabvine player myself, 20 even seems like a lot of land to me, but if you're going to play 20, I'd to justify playing 20 lands, I'd play three.
Okay. I'll start with three. So that's the good news. Now, the speculative stuff. I want to talk to you about the card Insidious Roots, David. This is one that we liked in our set review. We liked it as a brewing concept. In Pioneer, well, I'm curious to hear your take on Pioneer, but in Modern, it's becoming somewhat of a famous card. It's almost good. Right, there's a interaction with Cookbook and Oval Chase Daredevil. Very, very easy way, clean way to trigger the roots every turn. Sometimes multiple times a turn. And, you know, Aspiring Spike has been working on this. So his build of the Asmufood Insidious Roots deck plays red. So it's got Inti, which is another really strong combination with Cookbook and Daredevil. And he's also playing Dragon's Rage Channeler. It's a different version that is saying, okay, well, forget about the red. What I really need is to just get my Asmo as often as possible. And that means I'm going to build my mana base more heavy in green so I can fit in four copies of Finale Devastation. Finale lets you just get an Asmo for green. So that way you're just going to get more cookbooks throughout the game. And then when you draw your Insidious Roots, you're just going to go nuts that much faster. What I like about both builds is they're playing this card Seed of Hope, which is almost like the green Ponder. Since we're not playing Vintage, the green Ponder, Seed of Hope, happens to like mill two cards and then put one back in your hand. And that is satisfying the condition of Insidious Roots. Not that that's like a, you know, not planning to take a creature, but if you do, it's nice that that happens. It also just digs for your roots. So this is a card that like, the potential is clearly there. It's almost like a one card engine. Like you see decks like Yawgmoth just playing like a one of Insidious Roots. Because maybe the second copy is not powerful enough to justify the slot, but the first copy attacks from a new angle and it's just so powerful. I was wondering if I should try this in Crabvine, maybe as like a sideboard juke for the kinds of graveyard hate where they're exiling things from my graveyard.
I have seen lists playing like two or three main, which actually seems pretty interesting to me. What do you think about that?
Lists of what? Of Crabvine or Yawgmoth?
Yeah, of Crabvine. Playing Insidious Roots main.
Well, I didn't find those in the 5-0s, so I'm not sure what I make of that. There's no natural way to trigger it. Since we're not actually playing the cookbook thing, right?
So it triggers on Narcomoeba, right? Yeah. That works. Mm-hmm. Gravecrawler.
Mm-hmm.
Prized Amalgam leaving your graveyard.
Mm-hmm.
Bloodghast and Vengevine.
Correct. And I mean, these are all like the flex slots, the weaker interactions, the ones that get cut the most often, except Vengevine. So like, if you're going to find room for roots, I feel like I'd be cutting a good number of those cards. I'm not sure. I don't want to like spend mana. Does that make sense? Spending mana is for suckers.
No, I know. I mean, we're playing modern. Playing mana for spells, which is the base of all magic, is literally not something that's done very much in the format.
So almost all those creatures require some kind of mana investment. Nurkha Beaver requires Blind Luck. Blood Gas is like the easiest, but that's also the weakest. That's the one that I don't even play. But yeah, in the Crabvine Discord, I see some people saying, okay, you got to play four Blood Gas, got to play four Nurkha Beavers. Now you can play like Memory Sluice or something, and then you can play Insidious Roots. But these decks aren't winning, so I'm not sure if we're just like on the wrong track.
I mean, I'm not on the... I don't want to spoil anything for our listeners. I'm not on the Crabvine Discord, so... I don't know what list people are playing. I have a few like YouTube streams up right now. I'm looking at lists that people are playing. I don't know how good they are or not. It seems like there's a bunch of different ways you can build it. You obviously have pretty strong feelings about certain cards that are weak or strong, having played it through multiple like PTQ style events, 5Ks, 15Ks, et cetera, et cetera. So you should just think about the natural curve of like what your best hands are. But then think about the like natural curve of what your worst hands are. And if it's good in either of those scenarios, then I think it's worth main decking. Like, I like cards that make your best draws really good, or cards that are very good when your deck totally misfires. Those are like interesting cards to me.
Main deck, it feels like I win more. Yes, I could come up with a line in which turn two Roots was very powerful. It would let me win overwhelmingly on turn five. Or six, but the main deck plan is supposed to already do that. Like there are not that many decks out there. This may be wrong. There are not that many decks out there that their plan beats Crabvine's Undisrupted plan.
Except for just playing a two mana artifact on turn two with the ley line.
Yeah, I don't think Ritz beats
then
that.
They do it.
Yeah.
So if they do that on turn two, you're not even taking your second turn. You're just scooping them up, and we're going to a sideboard game.
Something like that. Yeah. Something like that. I mean, I guess I can draw my wonder, but I still can't attack. That's the problem.
I can draw my wonder. That thing flies. What? The dragon flies.
Well, yeah, because I need to block it. I need to like block it with multiple.
I need to block it.
I need to block it with multiple Vengevines. I need to at least stop it from attacking me until I can build up a million things on the board, and then I can Alpha Strike.
You can get a Souls of the Lost big enough. Maybe that's that. Maybe you're making the case right now for Souls of the Lost. It can attack into the dragon.
That's a great point. Yeah, I think I will play Souls of the Lost. Okay, so not a main deck Roots fan, I think, but I'm considering it for the sideboard. It doesn't work against Dothy Voidwalker, unfortunately, because those cards don't even go to the graveyard at all. But it's pretty good against Endurance, pretty good against anyone's playing Nihil Spellbomb in their Jund Saga decks or something. I consider it there. I'm not sure.
Jund Saga decks.
Yeah, people are saying it's going to make a strong comeback now that Rhinos is not holding it back. You know?
Well, you'll have a lot of time getting to play against the Jund Saga decks in the 2-3 bracket, I think.
Yes.
You'll be ready for them.
Yes. Getting real speculative, I want to talk to you about Snarling Gorehound. I've seen Deck Faden playing this, and this is a card that you first told me about, the card that you were trying to combo with in, I think it was Pioneer, right?
Yes.
Okay, so like walk me through what the card does and what's powerful about it.
So Snarling Gorehound is a one mana creature that moves permanents from one zone to another. So it's one of Dan's favorite things in the world. It's a black mana for a 1/1 menace. And whenever a creature enters play that has two or less power, you may surveil one. So very simple. It doesn't get any bigger. It doesn't get any smaller.
Surveil one is very good in Crabvine. One drops are very good in Crabvine, just to like trigger the Vengevine more often. I mean, at some point I was even playing that Larder Zombie, the one drop that lets you tap three creatures to surveil one. It was like pretty
good. Yes, I remember that. I remember us spending a lot of time on the pod discussing the various other draft chaff that you wanted to try to play with.
Exactly. The Gorehound could be a worthy heir to Larder Zombies legacy. But like I watched Deck Faden's video where the Gorehound allegedly went nuts with Insidious Roots, and it didn't actually happen. Like it never happened. It happened like one game in the league. So he got me with that title. I was baited. But But there's like a combo with this, right? So you were telling me about the Gorehound plus Roots plus some skeleton.
Yeah, I'll have to let me look at the skeleton right
moss,
now. I'm not
moss
even sure.
Pit skeleton. It's like it's juiced on Arena somehow, but in alchemy, I should say.
Yeah, so the combo, such as it is that the Moss Pit skeleton has a very weird text, which is when it's in your graveyard and a plus one counter is put on a creature, you may put it for free on top of your library. And this combines with the Roots and Gorehound in a very interesting way, because every time something leaves your graveyard, you get an 0-1, and that triggers the Gorehound, and that 0-1 gets a +1/+1 counter. So as long as you're ordering your triggers correctly, you are getting to make an infinite amount of plants, and they're all pumping each other up.
Mm.
You need something to start the loop.
So the skeleton without the combo seems worse than useless. Like, putting itself on top of your deck sounds disastrously bad.
Yeah, that's the main problem I found, is unless it's specifically in your graveyard and you have the Gorehound in play and you have Roots, it doesn't do anything.
Okay, so maybe that's like not worth going that deep, but curious, David, if you could just like catch us up on what you found when you were brewing around Roots in Pioneer. Since this is, I think, the more Roots takes off in Modern, the more people will wonder, can we build with this in Pioneer?
So you can build around it. The problem is always the consistency, right? You can build a deck that is good when Roots is in play. The Cat Oven combo obviously is fine. There's other, you know, combos you could play. You can play Nest. You can play, you know, the one that surveils two when it comes into play, but then you can exile it from your graveyard for a green to put a +1/+1 counter on a creature to start the loop. The problem is, how do you find your Roots?
Seed of Hope, baby. Seed of Hope.
All the terrible cards you're playing in your deck, like every other card you're playing is bad. None of these are even close to the right power level without Roots. And then once you find your Roots, you're way behind, because you're not playing Fatal Push, you're not playing Thoughtseize, you're not playing Counterspell, you're not playing Shock or whatever. So you haven't interacted with your opponent. Now can you stabilize? So even though, yes, if the game goes four more turns, you will add all this extra power, is your engine enough to stabilize? And right now the answer is no. The Roots decks are all very poor. The Cat Oven combo is terrible with Roots. It just takes so long. It's weak to sweepers because it takes you so long to set up your army. So yeah, I found it to be a very frustrating card. Even when you have the cards all come together, you don't even win all those games, right? Sometimes they just exile your whatever, and just, you know, the blue white is playing a 2-mana instant as its creature removal that also can destroy enchantments. So like, even your nut draw there just gets destroyed for, you can pump up your cat twice with the maps they gave you. So yeah, I just don't think this card is particularly good. It is the classic Brewer's Trap. Like, it offers you this great reward, but the things you have to do are just incredibly, incredibly complicated to get it to pay you off. And then when it pays you off, it doesn't win. It's like these cards you combo and you do like 11 damage. It's like, okay, your opponent's at 9. Now what? It's like, we can't win anymore. This game is over. Because we spent all these resources to do, you know, whatever, 12 damage for 3 mana. It's like, yes. We could have cast Lightning Bolt 3 times and we would have been kind of just there with all the cards we took to execute our combo.
You're saying it's not strong enough to be your main plan and to invest deck building resources into enabling it?
I mean, unlike Rhinos, which, okay, fine. I did all this work. I only get 2/4s. You didn't have to do anything. The deck building resources of this is like your whole deck has to be terrible cards that only work in a very specific circumstance. Like, not a single card that naturally works with this is a card you want to just play.
Hmm.
This doesn't even factor in the fact that, you know, Red Black Vampires is playing 4 ley lines that hit your graveyard, right? They're doing it for Phoenix, but you also just lose to them.
Yeah, not to put my beloved Crabvine Discord on blast, but there's like a Insidious Roots Brewing section there, and once they got to the part where someone's saying, yeah, we're going to build around roots and we got to play four Slitherheads. And people were chiming in like, oh yeah, Slitherhead. Like that's the enabler for roots. I was like, okay, I see the issue here. I see the problem. If you're putting in these do nothing garbage cards for the one scenario in which you draw the roots, that's not the way to go. So the future of roots is maybe it just a supporting player. Like if your deck already happens to enable it, it can be a one of, a two of. Plan C.
In modern.
Yeah, in modern.
Yeah.
Okay.
Again, modern already has these engines that were pre-built in Modern Horizons or whatever. And so if you're going to play those, so your base of your deck is already strong, right? Like Inti plus the stupid discard to your food thing, fine. You're already playing that. You can play a couple roots to support that as well. That just like extra pieces of your A plus B combo.
Okay.
And because your whole deck's just tutoring for one or the other, right? You're tutoring for your creature. The creature tutors up your thing. You could even play Urza Saga, which tutors up your artifact. You have easy ways to always have discard outlets online. There's no such card or series of cards like that in Pioneer. Like you cannot tutor up your one mana artifact to sack your cat.
I will heed your warning. All right, so given that I'm likely to play last year's Crabvine deck in Modern, that also means that I'm likely to scrub out and be playing in the Pioneer 5K on Sunday. David, what would you recommend for me?
I don't know. I mean, I think I would just play Phoenix, or if you wanted to, since you had success before, I would play Phoenixless Phoenix.
So just Drakes. I mean, does that deck actually have advantages? What's Phoenix weak to? How do you beat the Phoenix metagame?
First of all, I think Phoenix is a little overrated. Everyone talks about it had a 58% win percentage at the Pro Tour, even though it was the most played deck. You hear that over and over again. If you hear the same thing over and over again, you should really just check your priors. What you'll notice is it had a 78% win percentage against red-black midrange, but against red-black vampires, which normally is worse against it because they don't get to play Graveyard Trespasser main, they just sideboarded into the four ley lines to, as Reed Duke said, cheese it out. Well, yeah, sometimes you have to cheese out a deck that's unfair. So red-black vampires had a winning record against Phoenix. Now, of course, all the players on that team were great and the average Phoenix player is worse, et cetera, et cetera. We can do all these qualifiers. My point is, Phoenix is very beatable if you can attack its graveyard and then just play a reasonably proactive game plan against it.
I mean, it can't be that easy. Otherwise, more people would do it.
Well, the graveyard hate is only really good in black and white. The problem is that Hearse is not a good enough graveyard piece against Phoenix. They play artifact hate after board. They get to play the 3-mana sweeper that also like hits artifacts. Some of them are main decking. The blue-red command that, you know, does two, destroys an artifact, makes a treasure or loots twice. So, but Rest in Peace and the Black Ley Line are incredibly good against Phoenix.
Okay. So, in theory, I mean, what I liked about Drakes back in the day was that it ignores those cards for the most part. Crackling Drake itself doesn't get shrunk by any of that, so you can still win. However, I never had to contend with a 6/5 ward sack a creature type effect. Is there counter tech to that specifically from the blue red side if I was worried about vampires?
Yes. Check this out, dude. Tears of Alakut.
Excuse me?
Tech that shit out, people. Tears of Alakut. David Robertson coming through again.
Tears.
One in a red instant. This spell can't be countered. Do 5 damage to target flying creature.
Oh, boy. Okay, so ward is countering, so this just gets through the ward.
Yeah, just like when you abrupt decay a graveyard trespasser and refuse to pay the ward.
Fascinating. So that works as long as the Vein Ripper has not been grown. That should be good enough, right? Okay.
Also, main deck spell pierce. Phoenix is playing 2-3 main deck spell pierce. I would recommend playing main deck spell pierce. I would recommend playing Torch the Tower for Phoenix. Torch the Tower hit exiles Phoenix from the game and kills Sorin.
Gotcha.
So those, I mean,
yeah,
that's everything.
Yeah, I mean, I found like when people were still playing the bad old version of Vampires, Sorin into like Champion of Dusk, the Sorin, like, that's the problem. The fact that after killing the Champion of Dust, they still have the Sorin in play. Like, there's just, like, no clean way. There was no clean way at the time to just pick off a Sorin on one loyalty. But yeah, cleaning up a 4-4 is not a problem.
The thing you have to remember, if you kill their 6-5 and you have a creature that can attack, so okay, you play, I don't know what your two drops are. You're playing Ledger Shredder in your list, right?
I haven't built this deck in a long time, so I don't currently own that card, but I would probably play them, yes.
Or whatever your two drop is. Young Pyroman, fine. They tap out. They're on the play. Turn 3, Sorin. Mm-hmm. Vein Ripper. If you kill Vein Ripper and get to attack Sorin to kill it, you're ahead on a card, too, because all Sorin did was just make mana that turn. Think of Sorin as, like, spending a Dark Ritual to play, like, a Singer Vampire. Mm-hmm. If you can kill that for a cheap amount of mana, less mana, you're up on mana and you're up on a card. So you're, like, up a full mana, up a full card. That's, like, an insane exchange. That's why Pick Your Poison is, like, backbreaking. Like, you kill their blocker, you kill their Planeswalker, so now you're, like, up a card, up multiple mana. The swings are just crazy.
All right, so it sounds like you're saying blue-red has the tools. So if I like blue-red, I should just find a build I like in blue-red.
I mean, you could just straight up play Phoenix, but just because you've played Drakes before and you, like, teched out against other Phoenix lists.
True. Okay, that sounds like a good plan. All right, so I'm all set for Hunter Burton. This concludes our competitive portion of the podcast, which was 90% Crab Vine and Insidious Roots talk, but that's okay. You all knew what you signed up for when you hit play on this podcast. Let's shift gears, David. Talking about preview cards. So last week, we hit on most of them, but we have a few corrections, a few addenda to add. I mistakenly said that we do not know what committing a crime means, and that was not true. It turns out that we do know what committing a crime means. So tell us about the life of crime, David.
So you correctly predicted it would be an easy thing to do. So you were correct.
yes.
Basically, if you target your opponent with any spell or effect, and it's anything, a card they control, their graveyard, themselves, that is committing a crime. So it's backwards compatible, right? It's not what we like to call, you know, I'm spacing on the word, mechanic
parasitic.
That is parasitic. Yeah. So, you know, you have a graveyard trespasser in play. Every time you attack, you target a card in their graveyard, right? So that's just a free way to quote unquote commit a crime. You trigger your Duelist of the Mind.
It's an interesting way to kind of encode that game action. Saying that it's a crime, it implies like a lack of consent, like you're molesting your opponent, or whenever you finesse your opponent or something, you get to do this.
I am molesting my opponent. They had a card in their graveyard. Now Graveyard Trespasser has removed it.
Yeah.
So for someone, okay, we know strengths and weaknesses. Let's be self-aware. I love building mid-range decks, which means I like to interact. So this is basically a mechanic that says when David Robertson does the thing his deck is built to do, we're giving you something. We've built every card around this is like,
yeah, whenever he touches you, you get to do this.
Yeah,
thing.
Exactly. Whenever you go to confession in Ireland, right?
Yeah, boy.
So with that information, I think that Duelist of the Mind is actually a little bit better. It's a card that is going to loot almost every turn.
How so?
And it can probably loot on your turn, their turn. Now, people are comparing it to Ledger Shredder, which we underrated as a community. I underrated heavily. I don't remember where you were, but I thought this card wasn't even going to be close to playables. Modern staple, very powerful and Pioneer in one specific deck. And we had to print a whole new series of cantrips for it, but fine. This card doesn't get permanently big. That's the main reason that Ledger Shredder is so good. It's not the looting. So I think the comparisons to Ledger Shredder there are a little off, where people are like, oh, it can loot every turn. That people didn't understand. No, the thing is Ledger Shredder gets too big, right? It gets big enough that Phoenix can no longer kill it. It gets big enough that red removal can no longer kill it. That's the thing about Ledger Shredder. This card can attack for 2 or 3 a turn, which simulates Ledger Shredder on turn 2 or 3. But anyone who's had a Ledger Shredder go off a few times knows that, you know, now someone's attacking for 4 or 5 and is a huge butt to block. This can't ever really do that.
So is there any scenario in which it outperforms Ledger Shredder? It's probably easier to trigger Ledger Shredder than it is to commit a crime, right?
Well, I think in again, I don't want to compare this to Delver, but in more of a Delver style deck where, okay, I play this on two and just protect it. Like on my turn three, I push your creature and attack for two with this. And then on your turn, you cast a spell, I counter it. I get to loot with this again. And then I find another interactive spell and then I like loot on your turn, etc. That's the kind of thing I'm thinking about is you'll get to loot a lot more and you get to play counter magic, which is not a card you often get to play with Ledger Shredder. Because Ledger Shredder needs you to like proactively play, you know, two cantrips on your turn to get the trigger.
Right, so every counter spell is a crime. We've known this for a long time. Now they've formally acknowledged exactly. This. So I guess that is quite a different engine. Yeah, counter your spell and loot. It's like Burrell, Chief of Compliance. That's interesting.
So yeah, I mean, I think that scenario is very narrow. So I don't think this card is that good. But you asked specifically where might it be better. That's the kind of shell I could see it happening in.
That makes sense. What about Oko the Ringleader? So we talked about Oko, 4-mana Planeswalker, becomes a copy of a creature as his once per turn static, quote unquote. And then his +1 involves crimes. It's +1, draw 2 cards. If you've committed a crime this turn, discard a card. Otherwise, discard 2 cards. Gosh. I mean, you compare this to Tezzeret, Betrayer of Flesh last time, which is a haunting comparison. What do you think about it now?
So first of all, I got some of the rules wrong, so we need to clean that up. When it becomes a creature, it's no longer a planeswalker for the rest of the turn. So it doesn't lose loyalty if it takes damage, but you also can't activate the abilities for the rest of the turn. So that means normally you want your ability thing to trigger before combat.
Yes.
Or you don't want it to copy for the rest of the turn.
Right.
So again, a card that you'd like is a card that is going to be able to attack freely and is going to be able to trigger this thing the turn it comes into play. I would like the +1 at most of the time. I don't think -1ing your 4-mana Planeswalker to get a 3-3 is good enough. So like a card like Graveyard Trespasser, you play that on 3, you play Oko after you attack with Graveyard Trespasser, and you get to +1 it to basically super loot. And you go up a card. I don't know, what do we call draw 2, discard 1? I don't know, like, what is that a known historic term? There's a blue instant that you
cataloging, I guess.
Yeah. Like, cataloging is way better than drawing a card. It's, like, way better than drawing a card. So that's just something I'm trying to think of other cards that have, like, that are playable already that have, like, a free way of triggering the turn it comes into play.
Gosh. Yeah, not much comes to mind. Do any of the creatures that target things at the beginning of combat have the ability to target your opponent's stuff? Like a Reckless Stormseeker or a Luminarch Aspirant? You wouldn't want to do that, I guess. That's probably stupid.
Aspirant, I think, can't.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Oh, you know what's kind of cool? Okay. There's the green. I like this card more than most people, so people can poo-poo it. That's fine. The one in a green 0/3, and when you tap it, you exile a card from a graveyard. But it also makes a mana and gets an oil counter.
Armored Scrapgorger.
Yeah. So if they had a card, let's say you Thoughtseize on turn 1, Armored Scrapgorger on turn 2, you Oko and get to catalog, because Armored Scrapgorger will hit a card in their graveyard. I think it targets.
Don't check on that.
Well, no, maybe it can't target because then it wouldn't make the mana.
Exile target card from a graveyard. Yeah, targets. Okay, good. Illegal salvage from the opponent's graveyard. It's a crime.
So, yeah, I mean, that line actually sounds pretty intriguing to me, where we've got a turn 3 planeswalker that's already at 4 loyalty, that's already put us up a card, plus the looting has extra value in a deck, in a format with Delve, etc.
Hmm. Okay.
The other thing I think that would make Oko good is if you had like Stormseeker into Oko and then you make it a Stormseeker and then you like haste cards, like a 3-mana haste creature that Oko can copy on 4. I don't know what the best 3-mana haster in the format is that isn't legendary. But that's interesting to me as well.
So Stormseeker cannot target your opponent's things.
No, but I'm saying this, we're going to attack with it. So we're going to play Oko. We're going to make a 3-3.
Yeah.
The Stormseeker is going to give that haste. I guess the Oko becomes a thing. Whatever. So, some kind of haste granting creature. Then we basically play a 4-mana card that is also a haster that is also making a 3-3 before combat.
Yeah, I think that works, right? So you Stormseeker into Oko. Oko makes the elk. The original Stormseeker hastes the elk, and then Oko hastes himself. So that attacks four.
But Oko isn't a creature at the start of combat, right? So I think you need a creature that has that natively has haste.
You're right. I apologize. Okay.
So like, native okay, haste. Again, we're doing this off the top of our head here, but like, there's that old two in a red, it attacks, and you can exert it to prevent a creature from blocking.
On Crop Crasher, that's it?
Yeah. So, like, you can play On Crop Crasher attack on your next turn. You make Oko an On Crop Crasher after you make an elk. You attack with both. You don't let Oko untap. That's fine. You don't need to attack with it next turn. Like, there's a lot of, like, really aggro openings you can have there.
It's a shame these are all, like, the wrong color. Like, I don't think you're going to find a lot of haste. In...
Yeah, I mean, there's probably some green card that does it. I'm just, like, punting on it.
Yeah. Okay. So, potential for Oko. I'm still not quite buying it. I don't think I will change my grade on Oko the Ringleader, but we'll see. Presumably, there'll be a lot more crime support in the set, including a sheet, a bonus sheet of, like, famous crimes from the games past. So that'll be cool to see. Speaking of bonus sheets, so there's a second bonus sheet in Outlaws of Thunder Junction. More than just the breaking news crime sheet, there is also something called the Big Score. And I saw these cards, I just assumed they were Commander cards because they certainly look like Commander cards. It turns out they are standard legal. They're essentially an extension of the main set. They have a different expansion symbol, which is very confusing, and a different code. So the code is BIG, referring to the Big Score. Apparently, the backstory is that these were designed to be like a March of the Machines Aftermath style epilogue mini set, but after they designed them, Aftermath was such a huge sales flop that they just like squashed the whole idea and have inserted them instead into the boosters. But since they were designed at standard power level, they are declaring these legal in standard, pioneer, modern, etc. Of these 40 cards, we've seen two. We've seen a new sword called Sword of Wealth and Power, and we've seen a new 6-mana artifact. David, you want to take us through these cards?
Yeah, so Sword of Wealth and Power. We've completed the super cycle, or whatever they call it. All the swords of all the two colors have been completed. The blue-black one from the two sets ago was the last one. Sword of Wealth and Power, perhaps starting a new super set.
Oh, boy.
Equipped creature gets +2/+2 and has protection from instants and sorceries. Whenever equipped creature deals combat damage to a player, create a treasure token. When you cast an instant or sorcery spell this turn, copy that spell. You may choose new targets for the copy. 3-mana, equip 2, +2/+2. Those things are all consistent across all the swords.
It seems all right, actually. Instants and sorceries on its face seems like a promising set of protections. I don't really want to pay the mana for this, so I'm just imagining a Fervent Champion picking this up for free. What do I get if I do that?
Not much. You get a treasure, which is good.
Yeah. I cruise in for 3 damage with first strike. Hopefully they don't have a 4 toughness creature.
Yeah, the thing that's interesting is, okay, the protection from instants and sorceries is good once the sword is on it.
Yeah.
The problem is, if they have an instant or sorcery that kills a creature, they will cast it in response to you paying 5 mana, right, to cast this sword and crew it or equip for free. The nice thing about the other swords is they actually give you ways to hit, right? They helped you do combat damage to the opponent because you're nominally playing, you know, the blue-red sword against Murktide or whatever.
Right.
But I guess you could put on a flying creature or something. Spells to copy? That's an interesting question. Normally, we like to copy spells that require sacrifice. I'm thinking of, and I guess we'll get to it when we get to it later, but like, Shrapnel Blast sacking the treasure they give you is actually kind of sweet.
Gosh, it's just hard to come up with spells that I would also put in an equipment deck. Gosh.
Well, it's not an equipment deck. You could just play like 2 of these. If you've got, you could copy Treasure Cruise, Dig Through Time.
Well, if you're putting any equipment in the deck, that assumes a certain density of creatures, right? That's what I mean. Like enough creatures to take advantage of the sword, and then also have enough instants and sorceries to take advantage of this fictional scenario in which I connect with the sword. Just doesn't seem likely to me.
I do like, okay, so here's something. I like that this could go on adventure creatures, which kind of bring native extra instants and sorceries into your deck. So, okay, it's not that powerful, but at least you get to like copy the Stomp from Bone Crusher Giant or copy the Blink from Brazen Borrower.
Now that's interesting.
Or the green red dryad or druid or whatever the heck it is.
Questing druid.
Yeah, questing druid, sure.
Okay, so we're not totally writing off the Sword of Wealth and Power. What do you make of Nexus of Becoming?
Nexus of Becoming, 6-mana artifact. These are both mythic rare, by the way. At the beginning of combat on your turn, draw a card. Okay, we like that already. Then you may exile an artifact or creature card from your hand. If you do, create a token that's a copy of the exiled card, except it's a 3/3 golem artifact creature in addition to its other types.
I mean, it's cool. It better be cool if it costs 6. But I like how it gives you the card right away, how it does its thing the first turn you play it. Its thing could be, what, I guess, an Atraxa?
Atraxa is the first thing that came to mind, where the coming to play ability is kind of more important than its body, although the body on Atraxa is nice. At least it's still a 3/3 with Death Touch and Lifelink.
Maybe you don't need anything at the top end. Like, maybe just drawing an extra card a turn and spitting out 3/3s is enough. Well, exiling artifacts or creatures. You're exiling a real card to make a creature. That's...
Yeah.
That's probably just not worth building around.
Well, we do have ways to, like, cheat artifact mana in a way in Pioneer, in a way that we don't for other types of cards. So it's, like, you can play this quite a bit earlier if you're willing to play like Stern Lesson and things like this. This isn't like just 1 mana cheaper than Atraxa. It's like 2 turns earlier than Atraxa and not having to play any of the colors, just as a for instance.
Do you think 6 and 7 is a meaningful breakpoint? Because I really like that Thunderhead, that 7-drop from last set.
Thunderhead.
I'm butchering the name. 3-fold Thunderhulk. The one that like combos with God Pharaoh's Gift in to make a million Thunderhulks.
Are you talking about the gnome?
Yeah, the gnome. The 0/0 gnome that enters with 3+1/+1
cannons. Oh, yeah. There we go. Perfect. That's awesome.
Then at ETBs, you create gnomes equal to its power. So you would actually make... Oh, so you want to play both in the same deck.
Yeah.
So Nexus of Becoming into Thunderhulk. 6 gnomes right there. Yeah, okay. All right. I was gonna say that Thunderhulk just seems better than Nexus if I'm going to be investing in artifact mana.
But okay, I'm saying like we're playing our Stern Lesson deck, right? So we Stern Lesson on 3. If we have it, we just discard the Hulk and bring it back with the 4-mana Abuelos, whatever.
Right.
Or the 4-mana Return from Graveyard. And then if they hit our graveyard, because Stern Lesson's also a ramp spell, like Nexus of Becoming is very castable, like on turn 4 or turn 5.
Hmm. Okay. That's not horrible.
I think it's worth at least thinking through.
I mean, it will be horrible, but it sounds fun.
No, it will not be horrible. It'll be good.
Okay. All right, so that is the big score from Outlaws of Thunder Junction. There's also been some leaks. We're going to skip those because, you know, in just 2 short weeks, we'll have the real spoilers. Looking at Bloomborough, an actual set, there were a couple of cards that we glossed over. There's a mouse, there's an otter, there's a rabbit. Do any of these strike you as particularly playable for Pioneer, David?
I kind of like Mabel without there being any current playable mice. I just think the card's interesting. It makes extra pieces of cardboard, which we tend to like. So Mabel, Heir to the Crag Flame, is 1 red and a white for a 3/3 mouse soldier. Other mice you control get +1/+1. So it's a mouse lord. And then when it enters, you create Crag Flame, a legendary colorless equipment artifact token with a crypt creature gets +1/+1. It has vigilance, trample, and haste. We know those as like the Achroma abilities for those of us who are really old, who love paying 8 mana for a 6/6 creature. And equip 2.
So the part that you like is that it's 2 cards for 1, or do you think that the Crag Flame itself is powerful?
Well, okay, we have this whole soul package. So, like, it just turns every creature you play in the shell into a hasty threat. So you can imagine a bunch of cards you could play that we immediately get to give haste to and trample. So if we really are trying to, like, damage somebody with a specific card or a specific trigger. This in a shell with blue, because we're trying to play, you know, Omen Hawker, etc. Is pretty interesting to me.
Gosh, I mean, these are sweet interactions. Just going to that third color just for the interaction seems tough. I kind of wish Crag Flame did a little bit more.
Yeah, it'd be nice. I can't lie to you.
We'll see. We'll see what the other mice turn out to be. Adorable card, Mabel is the main character of the set, so we're told. I'm like a maybe on Mabel, and I'm not a strong maybe. And I think she's the best of them. I don't think there's much hope for Bria, Riptide Rogue, or Burke, Long Year of the Law. I could be wrong.
Yeah, they're both insanely powerful. They look like really great commander cards. But, you know, 4 mana and 6 mana for cards that need a bunch of other spells and other creatures in play is just...
Yeah.
We know what it is at this point.
Other loose ends. So, Universes Beyond, Assassin's Creed is one of the sets coming out in July, something like that. Turns out this set is Modern Legal. I just glossed over that because I think my brain didn't want to know. But this is the future we're all faced with. And the cards themselves are like not that interesting. I think they previewed 6 new ones. So it's a 100 card set, of which 80 of these are going to be new printings from the Assassin's Creed universe. These will all be in some kind of booster product, and you can also play them in your modern decks. Why? Because Wizards said so. Because Wizards feels like, I don't know, this is just the future of Universes Beyond. They've announced a big partnership with Marvel. They've announced Final Fantasy is coming next year. And it seems like they're setting the precedent that these cards will now go directly into modern. Not all of them. Like Fallout is not going into modern. That's just going into Commander, but Assassin's Creed is. So now we're going to have, like, I guess, like Leonardo da Vinci is a character in Assassin's Creed. Cleopatra is a character. So that's now going to be a thing you can do in modern.
Yeah, they need to be careful here. Right? They're flying pretty close to the sun. Like, I think Legacy's really took a hit when all these random mechanics that were like meant for casual play are like critical cards in Legacy. And it feels like you're playing like made up cards instead of like Brainstorm and like all these hits from Magic's past, and this is a big step in that direction.
Like, we knew this was going to happen, right? We knew they were going to start us off with Lord of the Rings so that when this discourse and chattering happened, people would always arrive at, well, we don't quite like it, but we're okay with Lord of the Rings because that's a beloved franchise, because it's like pretty close to the core of Magic's identity. Assassin's Creed, like, I just don't give a shit. I don't know. And Marvel, like, I fucking hate Marvel. I'm just going to come out and say it. It was interesting for a while, and then it became very uninteresting. And then that was many years ago. They're still making these movies. They're still giving Oscars to Robert Downey Jr. for some reason. I don't quite understand it. And now they're promising us a 4 year.
Well, he did not win an Oscar. Hang on. He did not win an Oscar for a Marvel movie.
And you won an Oscar for Oppenheimer, which was another terrible film. I don't know why people are so... I just don't get it. I feel like we're on the wrong path as a society, both with Marvel and with Oppenheimer and with Universes Beyond. But okay, point taken.
I can't sign on to all this. Robert Downey Jr. was excellent. Oppenheimer was great. Christopher Nolan is a great director. But I'm hearing you in generally the direction of the oversaturation of comic book movies was sort of the classic, like, kid that, why don't we just eat like chocolate milkshakes at every meal kind of a vibe.
Like, it's fine that stuff exists in the world. I have no desire to see that cross over into the magic that I engage with. This seems to portend the end of my engagement with modern.
Well, I've already stopped engaging with modern, so join me. Ziggy Zoggy, one of us.
Yeah. So I was looking at some comments, and the Dive Down did a great episode last week on like why everybody hates modern now. And some of the discussion on Reddit was about that episode. People just chiming in with like their gripes against modern. One that resonated with me was the idea that, yeah, Universes Beyond has somehow destroyed Magic's aura. Like, there's a fiction we live in which this is not just a game that we picked up as children that involves expensive pieces of cardboard. Somehow Magic preserved the idea of like high fantasy, classic, you know, the detail they put in their world building. I care about that in some way. And when it's just like Iron Man hits the board, I don't know. The cognitive dissonance, I can't maintain that anymore. So for me, it just feels, the quote here from 40 Crawlworms on Reddit is that now Magic just feels a little sad, corporate, formulaic, and cringeworthy. That's speaking to me. That's kind of how I feel about the whole enterprise. Like, it's not even the power creep.
Let me throw this at you, Dan. You tell me how many years it's going to be before we have an OnlyFans. Universes beyond.
Jesus Christ.
You're like, oh, Jenna Jameson has hit the, the table. We're working closely with Vivid and the...
oh, my God.
I'm so old, I don't even know what all the... Whatever the fanciest porn website is today.
In the future, cards are going to have QR codes on them because they'll want to like erratic them in real time. And once you've got that technology already on the card, it makes sense to have these brand partnerships with OnlyFans.
Well, then it's like those video games, right, where you mod out your main character. So it's not like a normal looking lady anymore. She has, you know, whatever exaggerated secondary sexual characteristics, etc., etc.
There are going to be some really interesting otter characters in that set.
Yes, right, well, that's...
Bloomborough is, of course, the furry set, the long end. The furry set, exactly. But we'll see.
Number one seller, so...
So I don't know. Like, I don't want to read these Assassin's Creed cards. Two of them, the Animus and Ezio, seem like sort of playable in Modern, but not really. I don't know, David. I just don't know anymore.
Well, we should go check out our latest blockbuster by... Denis Villeneuve, Dune 2.
Yeah. Universes Beyond, Dune. I don't know how I feel about all this. You just pick anything and that's going to be a Modern someday soon. All right, enough about that. Let's find a place of refuge. I guess the conclusion I'm drawing from this is that they've sacrificed Modern. They basically said Modern is going to become... It's going to be where we dump all this stuff, right? In order to like juice the sales numbers. So like, if we can put it on Arena, we're going to do that. We're going to make Historic on Arena absorb that. And we're going to make Modern absorb this as well. They haven't touched Pioneer yet. I hope it's like the Eye of Sauron. Like, we just hope to avoid attention. We hope that Pioneer can continue to fly under the radar, that they do not print any Pioneer Masters, that they do not declare any of these sets will become legal in Pioneer.
We're kind of like a Lando Calrissian. We're a small enough operation that the Emperor hasn't really noticed us yet.
Yeah, we had a deal. What the heck? You gonna alter the deal?
Sweet. Was that Bespin? Was that the name of the Cloud City?
Oh yeah, that's a deep cut. I don't know.
Watched a lot of the real Star Wars back in my day.
So what can we do in Pioneer? A format where we just have, you know, beautiful, authentic Magic IP, like Furries and Clue, the board game, and this sort of thing. Let's talk Murders of Karlov Manor. Let's talk about the Clue mechanic, investigate, and specifically the card Deduce, which is one in a blue instant to draw a card and investigate. So it's like a little bit of a think twice, makes a clue, does everything we like. Pretty good card. I mean, we've already seen it getting adopted by tier one decks. Blue white plays some copies. Nassif's blue black played four copies, as we talked about last time. It's a good creativity enabler, but that's not the limit of what you can do with Deduce or with clues in general. So David, you've been thinking about this and you've got some brews you're going to present to us here.
Yeah. So first of all, I think it's always a good sign when just generically powerful decks, right? I mean, obviously blue black is not a known archetype, but Nassif is a known blue-black proponent who, obviously, people can't replicate Nassif's success. That doesn't mean the deck is bad or good. It just means Nassif is one of the greatest players of all time. So he's just playing it straight up. No synergy whatsoever, other than, again, we always have to remind people that don't play Pioneer, things that turn on Fatal Push just have extra benefit, right? Like, the treasure from Fable just matters so much more in Pioneer than you'd think. It lets your 2/2 attack into my 3-mana card very easily because it turns on Push. This also does that, right? Whenever you want, you just have the clue lying around. And because it's instant speed, unlike something like Bankbuster, it plays well with counterspells, plays well in reactive decks. I think, unfortunately, even though it is a very good card in the shell, we really don't see the Indomitable Creativity or any type of transmog list. Those are just kind of like out of date. So I'm not going to propose those. I think there's still room to explore, though. Like, I think Indomitable Creativity is like a powerful effect. What the shell should be, right? It seems like you for sure need to play for Fable. You for sure need to play for Indomitable Creativity. And then what? I don't think anyone's sorted that out yet. And it seems like it's just a kind of a step behind. But putting an Atraxa into play is actually really good in a world where people are trying to dominate the sky with a 6/5 vampire. Mm. You're just way better than that. It's one of the few cards that just beats it and drew you whatever 4 cards for the trouble. So we're not going to propose any Indomitable Creativities, but I think that's also just a good place to start if you want like a base shell. Just play 4 to deuce without having to do too much thinking, and you can kind of pick the cards around it as you see fit.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, so we've talked about the good decks that can play to deuce. Now, the brews. The brews you can play with the deuce. I have here a teamer list that is trying to play to deuce with a series of 4 mana cards that each play with it very well. First of all, we have Kellen, Inquisitive Prodigy. Kellen, Inquisitive Prodigy, when it attacks, you get to destroy an artifact. And if that artifact is controlled by you, you get to draw a card. So it treats clues basically just like very easy draws. You don't often have to put the 2 mana into them. That's pretty good. It makes a clue already. That's pretty good. It was a little better before the new tech because it dominated the sort of adoption of the Looter Scooter. Blocks it because it's a 3/4 body, and then when it attacks, it just kills it for free. Now that red-black shell basically doesn't exist anymore, and the Vampire's List plays like 1. So its native ability to attack the format isn't that good. It's okay against white-red, Convoke, for instance, but deduce is kind of like juices it up a little bit, right? It just EOT, you deduce, you get the card for free when you attack. Okay, that's the first one. Second one, Galzeth Prismari. Galzeth Prismari, just the turn it comes down, now you have 2 mana of any color up. That allows you to cast Negate, that allows you to cast Torch the Tower, Growth Spiral, another deduce if you want. So that's good.
Yes. What can we do with this newfound power, David? We can cast another deduce. Yeah, I like that.
So what that does, though, is it sets you up to cast Alrun's Epiphany on your next turn. You could easily cast Alrun's Epiphany on turn 4. God Eternal Kefnet. So this is a Kefnet shell, and one of the reasons I wanted to play Kefnet is because I think it's really well positioned with all these effects. So deduce is both a card that we can proactively cast, so we don't... Okay, of course, deduce is much worse than Expressive Iteration. We're not arguing that. But with Kefnet specifically, reduces it down. The instant speed draw from deduce is great on their turn, right? You get another crack at God Eternal Kefnet on their EOT. And the clue it leaves behind, you can sack on their end step for God Eternal Kefnet. So the problem when you made these like 26, 27 land, Growth Spiral, and now we get to play the front half of Kellen, is you'd often flood because you didn't have Expressive Iteration anymore. I'm not arguing it had to get banned or not because of these mediocre tier 3 teamer lists I was playing, or 4 color lists with Omnath. But without Expressive Iteration to fix your draws in the mid game, it's very easy to flood. Now we have a built-in 2-for-1 deduce that lets us grind through the game. And our extra Growth Spiral effect, which is the front half of Kellen, is also another card that lets us draw. So it's a deck where we're playing 26 lands plus a Balaged Recovery, but we're also playing a shit ton of draw to fly through our deck. The 4 Growth Spiral, 4 Deduce, the front half of Kellen. And our counterspell is Divide by 0, which is a counterspell that we can proactively play with God Eternal Kefnet. And our sweeper is Ill-Timed Explosion, which is, again, a card that we proactively can play on Kefnet. You can just play blue-red, draw 2 in your upkeep, and then draw the Ill-Timed Explosion. So our counter magic works well with Kellen. That's rare. Our ramp works with Kellen. Our card value engine, even though it's worse than Expressive Iteration, is actually much better with God Eternal Kefnet. And then our sweeper works really well with God Eternal Kefnet. And then we still have like the lucky draws, right? You have Kefnet in play. You reveal Alrun's Epiphany. You cast it for 5. You take a turn. You cast Alrun's Epiphany the following turn for 7. And then the game functionally ends.
This deck has like a who's who of David Robertson 4 drops. It's
exactly.
God Eternal Kefnets, 2 Galazeths, and of course 4 Kellens. Those numbers seem a little bit off to me. Like, if Galazeth is so good, which it seems to be, maybe I would like to see like three or four Galazeths. I don't think we need all these Killens. That's a lot of growth spider effects, and I would want to play like 28 lands or something to have confidence in that. I guess you have 27. That's pretty close.
And remember that unlike Growth Spiral, Kellen does not need to see a land, so it can play Balaged Recovery. It just lets you play an extra land that turn. It's a little different.
But it is sorcery speed, right? I don't know. I'm just like wondering if Kellen is the weakest link. Like some of the lines you're describing, he can sack the clue from Deduce to draw a card, but that's just like saving you two mana. It's not actually going up a card, right?
Well, it's giving you a card. I mean, you could think of it as a six mana, 3/4 that makes a clue.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
I think I want to start with at least the maximum to see, because I just want to turn four my four drops as often as possible. That's my starting point. If I'm not arguing Kellen's like some super powerful card, mm-hmm. I am arguing that growth spiral effects or explore effects, as old people like us would call them, are very powerful, and I want to just max them out and see how good they are.
So the red component of the deck, for Torch the Tower, I'm guessing you consider it the most well-positioned of the cheap interaction right now.
Yes.
But Ill-Timed Explosion, three copies. So you have a lot of confidence in this, it seems like. Confidence that it will sweep the board?
Yeah, I think this card's really good, yes.
What makes it so good? I mean, when I see this, I see four mana. Okay, that's fine. That's not terrible. Could be three, but four is doable. Especially in a deck with so many growth spiral effects. But it requires you to have a big enough card in your hand to actually clear the board. There's not that many. I mean, you have three Elrond's Epiphany, but beyond that, the highest you can get is four on this. Is that enough?
Well, right now, we don't really need to sweep, per se. It's in there to take care of smaller to the ground decks. Basically, Convoke, Spirits if you play it. The like red and black chaff on the bottom end of the red black shell, but it's a sweeper that doesn't require double red, mm-hmm. so not needing to go red for anger was a big problem in these shells when you're trying to grow spiral on two, and you can still play it on three a large amount of the time because we're playing eight two mana grow spiral effects,
mm-hmm.
And then in control matchups or against like Lotus. It is a draw card. It's a bad one, but it does actually just straight up draw.
Yeah.
And it's a sweeper that, again, got Eternal Kefna that just turns into like an incredible card advantage engine.
Right. It's a bad divination, but when you hit it off Kefna, it becomes quite attractive. Just two mana draw.
And, you know, a bad divination in control matchups, like, they're just going to let it resolve, right? We both have six mana and I cast it. They're not going to counterspell it. Like, it is just, I'm just going up a card. Whereas their, you know, whatever, Supreme Verdict is just a dead card in the matchup.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. All right, so we like that from the red half. A few one-offs you put in here. So you put a one-off Repulsive Mutation. X, green, blue, instant to put X +1/+1 counters on target creature you control, then counter up to one target spell, unless its controller pays mana equal to the greatest power among creatures you control. So I assume you're treating this as a counterspell, right? But like, what's good about this?
I don't know that this card is good. it could be very bad. I just wanted to try it. The thing is, like with Galazeth or with all the extra lands we'll have in play, it also just gives us like finishing power. We have all of our four drops fly, and so you can cast it proactively, right? Like you attack into their 6/5 vampire, and they haven't cast a spell. I just +4/+4 my creature or whatever, and it just kills their vampire, for instance. Or if you have like Galazeth and just a bunch of lands in play, you can just basically fireball them out. That's the thought process. It's a pretty speculative card, though.
Okay, gotcha.
Also, again, it's another counter spell that if you have God Eternal Kefnet and it flips it, you just play blue green. It gives +2/+2 permanently to Kefnet.
So you like Alruns as your top end finisher. I mean, that's where the closing power of the deck would theoretically come from. Do you think that's actually enough to win the game?
Well, we also have the Divide by Zero package, mm-hmm. Which finds the 7 mana sorcery. Plus, our creatures all fly. And we also have a Mirex and a Hall of Storm Giants. So yeah, I actually think our closing speed is going to be fine. Again, we also have Repulsive Mutation. We can pump up a bird.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just a counterspell. I'm selling it short by saying that.
But that's why, that's one of the reasons why Divide by Zero is in here. It's not just a good card with God Eternal Kefnet, or like a great card against Cavern of Souls. It also just means you have access to like a finisher, right? You just get to find the 7-mana sorcery, you get to cast it, and you know, you're it's just a way to like turn all this extra mana, all these growth spirals and stuff into basically like finding a finisher.
Yeah, I was gonna ask if you were considering possibly like a Bring to Light package, because I always felt like that was one of the best ways to use Galazeth, is with Bring to Light. The Galazeth Bring to Light decks I've played, actually they were more in Modern, but they were built on like a similar spells core where I could see Deduce being an upgrade, although it does require you probably playing Valky, and that requires black, and it might just like change the texture of the deck.
Well, you could do that. I've built a lot of those shells. I have a shell I could propose. I just feel like I'm often proposing just like Bring to Light shells. And so this seemed more interesting to me.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, I agree. I think you could easily build, again, I do think you'd want to play Deduce. And I think you'll want to play the four of the, Kellens, because you need all the artifacts. I don't think you want to play white. At times we've splashed to get,
The Portable Hole, I think.
Portable Hole and things like that, but maybe you could play like the Shark.
There's the new black artifact that makes them sack a thing, but yeah, I'm not sure.
Well, no, I'm not actually going to play black. I think we'll just play black off of, well, very little. Yeah. But we maybe go up to four Galazeth, no God Eternal Kefnet, in that type of show.
Yeah, something like that. But that would not be proper Kefnet content, and we
well, it wouldn't be a Kefnet. Yeah, deck.
We are
exactly.
Now a Kefnet.
We've
podcast.
Got feedback. Exactly. So. I will construct that shell. I will have it in the notes for people, but this is the deck I want to start with, because I do like that Alderaan's Epiphany just goes over the top of what everyone else is doing.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay, so that's a teamer shell using God Eternal Kefnet, Kellen, Growth Spiral, and a very sweet package with Deduce, Galazeth, Divide by Zero, and Alderaan's. Where do we go from here?
All right. I'm very interested in trying to reenact the crime with Collector's Vault. Collector's Vault is a card that you highlighted during spoiler season. This is a 2-mana artifact. It is 2-mana tap, loot, so draw a card, discard a card, and make a treasure. Paying 2 mana for that is fine. It's not the end of the world, but if we have Enigma Jewel, we can do it for free, which means basically each turn it's just generating a treasure. And if we open on Enigma Jewel, Collector's Vault, end of their second turn, loot, make a treasure. On our third turn, we loot again, and we can put a Shark Typhoon that we loot away into play. We can put an Atraxa that we loot away into play with Reenact the Crime. And if we're going to play Enigma Jewel, then Deduce is just a fine like value card as we kind of ramp our way up the chain. The other thing that's cool with Collector's Vault is it does just ramp you, right? You activate Collector's Vault 3 times, and on turn 4, you just cast Atraxa, the treasures, you know, give you an Atraxa.
I was probably too high on Collector's Vaults. Like, I envisioned it as a mirror breaker even for control decks in a way like somehow similar to Reckoner Bankbuster, where just the ability to filter your draws while accumulating a mana advantage would be good enough. I hadn't really thought through how powerful that can be, the jewel plus the vault, right? It's now like taps for free, makes a treasure. You still get the filtering. What do you make of this core, David?
I don't know what the right core is. I'm only playing red because I think Fable is so good with Reenact the Crime. So it lets you discard in your next turn. Often you'll get a treasure when you attack with your goblin, or even if you don't, right, you just find your fourth mana. Reenact the Crime has 3 blue in it. If you don't want to play Fable, you could easily play black in the shell. I love the shell. Most of the games you open on Enigma Jewel, Collector's Vault, I think you're going to win easily. The problems are when you don't open on that, right? That those are the issues. Deduce is not as good in the stack because we aren't playing hardly any interaction. So like you don't really put them in that bind of like, do they have Deduce? Do they have Make Disappear, Censor, whatever, the negate? We're playing, I still have 4 Shark Typhoons in here. I started out with 4 Jewel and 4 Omenhawker. But then I cut the Omenhawkers because I wanted like a Transmogrify or 2 maybe as a possible hit. So then maybe you don't want all 4 Shark Typhoons, but then maybe you don't have enough creatures for the Transmogrify package. So there's a lot of variables here. The idea of opening on one of the soul cards, if you want to go up to 8 to maximize how good your Collector's Vault is, into Collector's Vault with some kind of reanimation spell. Maybe it isn't reenact the crime with an Atraxa, or you can pick a different hit if you like. I think that's very real. I think that's really powerful.
Huh. So the line you're envisioning, turn one jewel, turn two vault, even though you've just invested two cards for nothing, essentially, you haven't really impacted the board, you still feel like that puts you way ahead in against the field.
Well, on your next turn, you can easily have five mana. Right. So, like, you're almost all the way to casting Atraxa on the next turn after that. You can just hard cast Atraxa, even if you don't loot it away, even if you don't find reenact the crime.
Well, is that true?
Yeah, so turn three, you play your third land, and you have two treasures in play. The turn four, you'll have your fourth land, you'll have three treasures in play.
Oh, boy. Okay.
So that opening is the thing that's inspiring to me. Now, the other thing that was kind of cool, again, this, you can tell I'm still kind of like thinking about all my options here. Omen Hawker lets you just tap to straight up cycle Shark Typhoon. Right. So for four mana, you can get a Shark Typhoon and play with Reenact the Crime. So that's kind of interesting as well. The problem is you're starting to run out of like interactive pieces because you also want to play Fable. It's so good with Reenact the Crime, but maybe you want to get rid of red entirely and just play black and abandon Fable and abandon Reenact the Crime. But you could play like Blood for Bones or some of the five mana resurrection type effects with Atraxa.
Yeah, that four mana reanimation spell, you couldn't think of the name of it before. Shaelred something.
Yeah.
I think you're correct to not play Omen Hawker. Like, I think the jewel should be enough, even though doing that Shark Typhoon reenact with the crime line does now require five mana with a jewel, but that's still like good enough, right? It ought to be good enough.
I hope so. I mean, it just seems really good, right? Like, once it's in play, we just like cast Fable, get a 3/3, cast Transmogrify, get a 4/4. I mean,
once you've decided you're going to be a four Enigma Jewel deck, you do need to have enough stuff that the jewel can power up to like make it actually a card. So the vaults, yes. Deduce gives us a little more confidence. We'll have something to do with the jewel. But that's not enough, right? You need more stuff. So the Shark Typhoons gives you now three things, three, four ofs. But you've seeded throughout the deck a couple other effects like this, right? I see in your land slot some activated abilities.
Yeah, so Murex is awesome, right? Turn two, you can actually make a 1/1, which is pretty sweet. With Murex. Then we have Odawara, we have Sokenzin, we have a Hall of Storm Giants. Celestis is actually awesome. So you can play Celestis on three. If they don't play any spells, you just get to loot for free on your turn. So you can cast Reenact the Crime, or on your turn you can tap a jewel and a land and Celestis force discard, like switch the day to night again.
How does the timing work with day, night, and Reenact the Crime?
Reenact the Crime just says this turn.
So if I let it become night, right? So I play my Celestis and the next turn I just pass so that I can have it flip.
Yep.
Goes to my yep. end step, and then do I still have time to reenact the crime?
Yeah, reenact the crime is any time that turn, I believe. I'm pulling it up now so I don't lie to our listeners here. Yeah, this turn.
I guess my question is, when does it become night? Does it become at the end of your turn?
During their upkeep.
During their upkeep.
That's the triggers and during your upkeep.
Gotcha. Okay.
So you pass the turn, it's their turn, you discard Atraxa. Now, okay, they've got Shieldred in play. Are they going to attack you?
I see.
Seems like they should. They've got a Fable of token in play. Do I have a reenact the crime? I don't know. I did just loot.
Interesting. All right. That's pretty intriguing.
So there's a bunch of different shells you can build. Reenact the Crime locks you into a very blue-heavy shell. So that's worth noting, but we are making treasures every turn, hopefully with Collector's Vault. You can play black. You can play black-blue. You can play some number of Omen Hawker. You can play no Omen Hawker, you know, etc. There's just a bunch of... I mean, I'm playing Four Torch of the Tower and Two Make Disappear and not a lot of other interaction. You can play more interaction. You can go all in on the combo and play very little interaction.
That makes sense. Like, I guess my question is, what role does Deduce play in the deck? Is this only real function is to justify the jewel?
Well, it's just a straight 2/1.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
I mean, you just need ways to like see a lot of cards in your deck.
Right.
But it's a great point. Like, maybe what you ought to be doing is only playing like two Deduce an extra Celestis and, you know, some other like stuff that like that's a possibility too. This is definitely not the best deduce deck, but these are all shells that are, you know, where deduce and some number is correct. Yeah, as a four of, I started there because it's deduce weak, but, and we'll get to it later. I have just these like card clusters that I just want to like kind of talk through. Maybe people can like sort out the mad ramblings that I'm like cascading through my head.
Right. Okay. I mean, the deck looks like a solid concept. I like how it has redundancy. The collector's vaults can filter away whatever is not useful. So you're not punished for playing four legendary Enigma jewels, not punished for playing extra collector's vaults. Even seems pretty sweet. Anything else on this one or should we go to the next one?
No, that, I think that's good.
I see those tears of Velikut in the sideboard. That's the tech, baby.
Telling you guys. Thank me later.
All right, so next up, I see that we are in blue-white, but we are not playing No More Lies. We are instead playing Permanence.
So we are up to the full eight soul effects in this one. We are four Omenhawker, four Enigma Jewel, three Alquist, Proft, Master, Sleuth. So for people who don't remember, one, a white and a blue for a 3/3 human detective. And when he comes into play, he investigates, so he makes a clue. And then you may pay blue, blue, white, and X, sack a clue, draw a card, and, excuse me, draw X cards and gain X life.
Sphinx's Rev, baby.
Sphinx's Rev. But we get to, like, cheat on the Sphinx's Rev cost because we have the soul effects, and the soul effects can go paid into it. So even if you only have three mana up and a soul effect, you just get to tap out on the end of their turn, and you just draw two, gain two for just sacking a clue. That's the bare minimum. The three mana it took to play Alquist plus a soul effect, that is two life and an extra card for the clue. And of course, every turn for the rest of the game, you're playing lands, hopefully, because you're drawing two from your first one. So we are playing four Thraven Inspector, one Novice Inspector. Deduce is actually a clue maker. In my original proposed shell for this, if people saw my preview, like my first bruise for the set, I had Bankbuster. Deduce is actually way better here. It's instant speed, so it lets us play like a control shell because we have all this instant speed interaction. We have Shark Typhoon, Wandering Emperor, one Mirror Shell Crab, four Metallic Rebuke, three Get Lost. So we're functionally like a mid-range deck that has like a control shell around it. And then as we get into the late game, like Alquist is like a must-kill threat. A Giant Shark is a must-kill threat. Wandering Emperor actually gives us removal outs. It actually kills even, if you wanted to, Vane Ripper. Right? They attack with Vane Ripper. You make a 2-2. And then the next turn you exile it for two life and sack your 2-2. That's if you don't have a Thraven Inspector or something in play, which this deck often will. So we actually have outs to Vane Ripper. We can counter Vane Ripper very easily on turn three. We've got a million ways to do that. And then we just have all this advantage that we can accrue throughout the game.
The play patterns look super interesting. So your one slot is all permanent. So you're going to play these on your turn. You're going to spend one mana to invest in Omenhawker, an Enigma Jewel, or one of your inspectors. But then once that's happened, you're primarily going to play it instant speed. You're going to sit back on interaction. Rebukes, Get Lost, Deduce, or just cracking the clues, cycling Shark Typhoons, flashing in Wandering Emperors. That all makes sense, except for this Alquist, right? Alquist requires tapping out again. But is the idea that he's just so powerful?
Well, the idea is, one, it gives you, like, an out, so they, you know, cast a sweeper or something. That's when we just resolve our Alquist, and now they have another card that they must kill. Also, because Alquist makes an artifact, we only, on turn four, we can play it with Metallic Rebuke up, right? As long as we have one other artifact in play. Mm-hmm. So a tap out, I mean, you're talking about tapping three mana on turn four. That's not really like a tap out card as I would define it.
Okay, so you're not going to like slam him as soon as possible. You're going to...
I mean, obviously, there's probably matchups where you would. Like, for instance, against red-black, if you knew that they were going to play Fable on turn three, this is a great card to play before Fable. Blocks the Fable token and gives you a ton of value. Against red-white Convoke, this actually blocks very well. I mean, it has Vigilance, so you get to attack in the middle of all this, and it does give you life back. So there's like mid-rangier matchups where they're not going to go over the top of you, then I think this is a card you tap out for. But against Lotus, or if you suspect that they're going to Sorin you or something, then you won't tap out until you have counter magic up. And you don't need to, exactly for what you said. You just, okay, they don't play anything, but we got so much instant speed stuff to do. Just deduce, draw two. Okay, my turn again.
I guess that's my last question is, do we actually have enough interaction? We may be like high on our supply with all this Thran Turbine effects and cracking clues, but there's not actually that many cards in here that interact, that commit crimes, we might say. There's four rebukes plus a mirror shell crab, so that's five counter magic effects. There's three get lost in a portable hole. Then the Wandering Emperors. That's just like not that many cards that actually mess with the opponent's stuff. Do you think that's enough?
I mean, seven removal spells, five counter spells. Okay, let's just look at red black. They play four Fatal Push. They play one 2-mana removal spell, and they play four Thoughtseize and one Duress. So we're playing like five counter spells instead of five hand disruption spells. We're playing seven removal spells instead of five removal spells. And we get to play Iganjo, which we get to play for cheap. And we get to play Odawara, which we get to play for cheap.
I'm going to check the numbers on that. I feel like when you actually add up how many of the creatures in red black interact with other creatures, they have quite a lot of interaction. More than we have. But I take your point. Okay, maybe it's fine. And we are drawing plenty of cards, so we'll see the interaction we put in.
And again, there's a lot of cards you can cut, right? You don't have to play any Alquist. You can play one Alquist, right? If you want to turn the other two into removal spells, if you think you just have enough to do it. You could play no Alquist. You could play no Portable Hole, and you could play like the fourth Emperor. You could cut the fifth Inspector. If you didn't want that, you could play another removal spell there. So there's a lot of different places you can cut. You could go up to multiple Iganjos. We are playing 24 lands plus the 8 soul creatures. You could play multiple Odawaras.
Yeah, true.
Like, Iganjo's not well positioned right now, though, is the one thing I would say.
Is it fair to say that this blue-white pile reflects your current clue power rankings? Like, you like the deduce and the first four or five inspector effects before going to anything else?
Yeah, because like you say, the tapping out on turn one is the most acceptable time to tap out, and tapping out on turn three is, you know, less attractive, even though Alquist is super powerful.
Okay.
If Alquist had flash, we'd be having a different conversation altogether.
I mean, there's Secrets of the Key, baby. That's flash. If you want clues, we can have clues. Maybe that's too far.
Yep, but sure. I mean, it's not crazy to play it over the first Novice Inspector, like the first one of those. Could also play Filched Falcon or whatever the heck that's called.
Ooh, Filched Falcon. Okay, so you have that in your next thing here, which, as you mentioned, is not actually a deck, but is a collection of ideas.
This is not a deck. For people who have the subscription and they can see, I've constructed a deck list, but it is just columns of cards that work well together, and I just kind of want to talk through like these packages of cards.
All right, take us there.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about the rule of eight we have with Enigma Jewel and Omen Hawker. So we know those cards are great with Deduce. It turns Deduce into a 2-mana instant draw 2, which is broken. If you're turning it into that consistently, it's way better than Expressive Iteration even to do it at instant speed. Now, you're down the original card, right? You're down the Enigma Jewel. But if you're getting enough of those types of effects, that's super powerful. Also very attractive with the card Gleaming Geardrake. Now, I didn't propose a deck with that, but this is a card I'm totally fascinated by. So red and a blue for a 1-1 artifact creature with flying. Drake, not dragon, unfortunately. When it comes into play, it makes a clue. Whenever you sacrifice an artifact, it gets +1/+1 per counter. So let's just imagine turn one Enigma Jewel, turn two Gleaming Geardrake. It really is the Tarmogoyf, the thing that I always want, like some of these cards to be, which is a Tarmogoyf that draws a card. It threatens to get huge quickly. It, you know, they stack on themselves. So if they have a removal spell for it, we're up a card, just straight up a card. Deduce is a great card with that. The Soul Package, you can imagine all working together. Okay. Collector's Vault with the Soul Package. We just discussed it. Collector's Vault makes a treasure a turn. So maybe you don't want to do the combo thing with Atraxa. Making a treasure a turn means we're pumping our Geardrake every turn while going up full mana with Omen Hawker and Enigma Jewel. Okay, that's something to think about. Or maybe you combine that with some kind of Atraxa shell. I don't know. Case of the Filched Falcon. One blue mana comes into play and makes a treasure. It's solved when you have three artifacts in play. So Filched Falcon turn one, Geardrake turn two solves it. At any point after that, 3-mana instant speed, you turn any artifact that you want, you make it a 4/4 flyer. Enigma Jewel also works really well with that, right? It can sack the clue easily. Once you've solved the case, it actually can pay for the three mana to turn it into something. So, okay, is there a deck there? I'm not sure. But that's all interesting. You can play Spyglass Siren or Voldaren Epicure. They give you one more artifact that sacrifice that trigger Geardrake or help you solve the case, and you can pay with your Omenhawker or Enigma Jewel to solve those things. So that I've just described a bunch of cards that could all be some of the deck, all of the deck. I don't know. That's one kind of like shell to think about. It's like a value artifact shell.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that case of the Filch Falcon into Geardrake. That solves it so quickly. Although I was thinking of the solution to the case as the last thing you would do in the game, because it's not very mana efficient. But are you saying that you could actually see that being the curve? Like turn one case, turn two Geardrake, turn three, pay the two in a blue to put four counters?
I mean, it could be. The point is it just gives you the option. The other reality is like maybe you just leave all your mana up. If you're worried they're going to sweep or something, or what's the white, the three mana white enchantment, you just draw a card with your Geardrake or sack your clues. And leave your case of Filch Falcon in play. So when you Odawara their enchantment later in the game, all of a sudden you get all this value back. I think that's maybe a way to play it as well.
Gotcha. Okay.
Okay, so that's one package we can think about. Package two. The soul package can work in an equipment shell. I've tooled around a little bit with this on Arena because we have two swords, the red-green sword and the blue-black sword, and they're actually pretty good when you don't have to pay to equip them. So Omenhawker is actually even better here because it's a creature that can tap to, like on turn three, if Phoenix taps out, you just play your red-green sword, crew it to Omenhawker. They only have red removal in their deck, so now they can no longer target Omenhawker. And if they don't have a blue blocker, you get to attack and get the sword's ability. Also, we mentioned the card Fervent Champion. That also equips for free. So functionally, it's like you have 12 of these effects, if you want to think of it that way, to crew up your sword. Maybe the new sword we just talked about, if this is something we decide we want to pursue. Also worth thinking about is Diamond Pickaxe. Either crews for free to Fervent Champion, again, is a crew 2, so it works perfectly with Enigma Jewel or Omenhawker. That makes a treasure a turn. Is that relevant if you're playing Gleaming Geardrake? Something to think about again. Also indestructible if you want to crew that with your case of the Filch Falcon, etc., etc.
I like that.
Also, Cryptic Coat was in the deck I was tooling around with Arena. So you play Cryptic Coat on 3. If you can crew immediately onto that creature, it's an unblockable creature. The body it makes has Ward 2, so it's hard for them to keep up removal for when you try to equip your sword to it. And then it's unblockable, so it doesn't matter if they have a creature in place. You're attacking for 5 every turn, plus the trigger from the red green sword or the blue black sword. And the blue black sword can rebuy Deduce if you're playing that in this shell, or Shrapnel Blast. Those are 2 mana cards that are very powerful, 2 mana instants that you might be playing in that shell.
I hadn't really thought about the interaction of Enigma Jewel and Omenhawker with equipment. In Modern, right, all of this stuff, if you say equipment, you're immediately thinking Stoneforge Mystic, where you just get the equipment for free. Pioneer doesn't have anything like that that actually super pays you off for just like playing the equipment card type. So I think there's just like a net liability on balance, as cool as these interactions are. But is there some card that turns that around or like makes the equipment like a nice bonus? Like, is there a Stoneforge type thing we should be looking at?
We started with the Kellen that tutors for like a 1 and a white. The mana was just so bad. You can't play Jeskai in these colors because you want blue on turn one. So the other things that matter, like the 2-mana dwarf that draws a card whenever you play an equipment, for instance.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've had reasonable success again on the ladder, so it means nothing. But there's definitely something there. Like Cryptic Coat can also be put back to your hand for cheap with the effects from the soul cards. So you can replay that over and over again as a value card, eventually draw your equipment. But yeah, equipment in general, right? You're soft to creature removal. You don't get to play that much interaction. And unfortunately, unless you specifically have Cryptic Coat into the sword, your clock isn't that fast. So maybe you need to play Double Strikers. I don't know what the answer to that is.
Huh. Interesting. Okay.
All right, next package. Deduce and Shrapnel Blast is a rule of 8 of very powerful 2 drops that Arcane Proxy can buy back. Now, in the original Arcane Proxy Week, we tried to put, what is it, See the Truth, Dan?
Yeah, See the Truth.
We get to go, you know, you don't want to cast the front half of that. It's super annoying. Or you have to find some way to loot it away or something else to get your draw three out of it. Deduce is just a card we want to play. So we could play Enigma Jewel on turn one. We leave up Counterspell on turn two. We play Deduce. We get our second card out of it. And then we immediately Arcane Proxy it back. It's literally a three mana 2/1 that draws two. It's also an artifact, so it naturally comes with a body for Shrapnel Blast. So if you Shrapnel Blast them, then cast Arcane Proxy. You've done 10 damage to them no matter what.
Well,
again, Shrapnel Blast, it sacks an artifact, so it triggers Geardrake. Torch the Tower is another card that can sacrifice an artifact if you need something to trigger Geardrake. The other card that's kind of interesting to buy back is Behind the Mask, a card that Dan highlighted, so it makes a creature 4/3. If you're looking for extra cards for Arcane Proxy to target, including maybe a flying creature that's a native 0/0 but has +1/+1 counters on it from Filch Falcon, right? You just make it a 4/3 for turn so it does 8 damage in the air.
So I'm pretty low on Arcane Proxy, both from our experimenting with it and from trying to play it in like a Neoform Atraxa deck where it was just like so much worse than the actual good cards. So I'm skeptical when you say that Arcane Proxy flashing back anything is powerful. Now Deduce, I have to grant that is pretty good. Proxy getting back Deduce sounds great. Proxy getting back Shrapnel Blast. A, I just feel like the Shrapnel Blast is unlikely to be on plan with the Proxy. And B, you still have to have something to sacrifice, right? Like they can kill the Proxy in response if that's your only artifact in play. So it's not totally guaranteed that you'll have the 5 damage. And C, it's still only 5 damage. Like, it doesn't kill them.
Yeah, but it's just a 3-mana spell. Also, in your example, we're just trading a creature for a removal spell. Like,
yeah, alright.
I like when we can imagine ways where we don't have to resolve very many cards to win. Like, we get in there for a few damage, we Shrapnel Blast them on EOT, and then we just flash it back, and then all of a sudden they're just dead. That's interesting to me.
Okay, so you're liking Shrapnel Blast as the beginning of a sack package that is completed with these other effects, Geardrake, Torch the Tower, etc.
Yes, exactly.
Do you think that, I mean, ignoring that side, if you believe me that Shrapnel Blast is not actually good, but you do like the proxy into Deduce, is there like a different card that, different direction that would go?
We could, since we're already excited about it. If we're playing the Soul Package, we can play Collector's Vault, so it's very easy for us to loot away a variety of cards.
Like Arcane Proxy.
We could loot away Arcane Proxy. We could loot away See the Truth. But yeah, the problem is there aren't that many like native red cards that just do damage to them that are worth doing, right? You can only get 2 damage for 2 mana. I guess you could Lightning Strike them. You could play Grixis if you wanted a Thought Seizer push, of course. There aren't that many other cards, though, unfortunately, that are that interesting.
I mean, one of the things that like never happened was paying the full 7 for Proxy and getting anything useful out of that. But maybe with Vault, we could actually do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's very... It can target Reenact the Crime.
We haven't like found...
Or Blood for Bones.
We're just spinning our wheels so far, but man... Okay, I'm with you. I'm with you. Continue.
All right, and then the final package I want to talk about are cards that benefit when we sack artifacts. So there's a bunch of them now. We have Sir Ginger and Geardrake and Crime Novelist. So like, I don't know exactly what the shell would be, but if we imagine we have Crime Novelist in play and we cast Big Score, just like incredible cards, free. We get to loot through our deck, and then we're just adding 2 native power minimum to our board. So each of those cards gets a +1/+1 whenever an artifact is sacrificed or goes to the graveyard in the case of Sir Ginger. Crime Novelist also, whenever an artifact is sacrificed, gives you an extra red mana. So when you cast Big Score, you get 2 treasures. Each of them sacks for any color you want plus a red. So you get the 4 mana back immediately.
So you're grouping Crime Novelist with Sir Ginger and Geardrake as just large threats, essentially. And the Novelist makes mana as well, which is nice, but you're saying that that's not really the point. Like, you're not trying to combo off with it with animation module.
Well, you could be. I don't know. I'm not proposing a deck here. I'm just saying if you're going to play Novelist, you probably want other cards that are going to pay you off when you start doing your big score thing.
Right. But you're saying that the Novelist might just be big enough on its own, right, as a threat.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, are you playing the Soul Package in this deck or not? I don't know. Are you just playing a bunch of native Treasure Makers in your deck? I don't know that. Again, these are just cards that work really well together. There's replicative effects. You saw I did like a deep dive of anything like Makes Treasures that is like reasonably playable. Goldspan Dragon, Charming Scoundrel, Breaches if you're playing like maybe Spyglass Siren. Galzeth comes with a treasure. Treasure Chest from the D&D set if you want to spend 4 mana to maybe get 5 treasures. Prismari Command. Maybe Diamond Pickaxe again. The other thing that's cool is when Crown Novelist is in play, even if you don't have a soul effect, if you activate Collector's Vault for 2 mana, you get that 2 mana back. So it's functionally a free activation because the treasure you get there gives you 2 mana back in addition to pumping your Crown Novelist and any Gear Drakes or Surgingers you have in play. Again, Surgingers lets you scry. Another card to think about in all these, there's a bunch of effects that like sack an artifact. So there's that colorless artifact that costs 1. You sack it for 1 colorless. You exile the top two cards of your deck, and you can pick one and play that until end of turn. And then it has you can play it from your graveyard for 1 and a red.
Yeah, the Mishra's Research Desk.
So each of those sacrifices is triggering your Crime Novelist or whatever. Like if you want to do something like that.
Crime Novelist is kind of interesting. I mean, these are interesting lines. It feels like it happens somewhat late in the game, so I would need to make sure that we weren't dead before we did this. But the sound is pretty sweet.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, the other thing you could think about with Crime Novelist, if you wanted to, is Synthesizer.
Okay.
Right, so you stack Synthesizer for 3 red. You get a red back immediately.
Yeah. I mean, Synth, I love that with the Jewel as well. So that we're going somewhere.
Yeah, but then, like, I don't, like, we're just running out of slots here, right? Like, so, I don't have deck lists here. I'm just, like, all these cards work really well together in certain combinations, and then, like, which ones do you want to try, and then how much interaction can you staple to them while still having enough to be on plan? That's not known to me.
Hmm. Okay.
But, like, casting Big Score with Crime Novelist in play is just going to lead to something sweet. That for sure is true. But even with Geardrake in play, like you just get 2 treasures, you can sack the clue that's left over, and your Geardrake is getting +3/+3. Like, this is really good.
These effects that trigger on artifacts being sacrificed, I mean, they're so powerful with treasures. The treasures are like a precious commodity. They're hard to make. Whereas clues are becoming cheaper and cheaper, right? They're just giving you clues all the time, especially with Deduce. So are you envisioning that this deck could play both, or do we need to like pick a direction, treasures and clues?
Yeah, I don't think the Crime Novelist, Gleaming Geardrake, Sir Ginger deck would play Deduce. I think this deck would be more about like setting up your like combo-ish turn. Maybe it would even have like fling effects because it's pretty easy to block like Crime Novelist.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm guessing you wouldn't play Deduce, and you probably wouldn't play the like Soul Package. I'm guessing you'd just play like maybe just like Voldar and Epicure kind of thing, or a Spyglass Siren.
Okay. All right, I like it. So we have the seeds of many, many decks here. Some with clues, some possibly without. Many of them with sacrifice packages, some with Crime Novelists, a lot with Enigma Jewel. So we didn't formally do a week on Enigma Jewel, but you know, we predicted this would be a productive card for gathering our brewing energies. And yeah, I mean, I love to see all these concepts coming together. I do think we'll run out of slots pretty quickly, but that's part of the challenge.
Yeah, so not strictly a Deduce shell, but, you know, Deduce fits in some of these. The thing is with Deduce, you want ways to get the card out of your clue or to do something with your clue, right? So is that Galzeth or is that Omenhawker or is that something else?
Yeah, exactly. All right, any final thoughts on Deduce, David?
Super sweet card. Hopefully we can find something useful to do with it.
Yeah. Well said. I mean, I like the looks of this first list, and we gotta get that KefNet 5.0. We owe it to the people at this point to get that God Eternal KefNet 5.0. Maybe this is the card in the week to do it. All right, before we go, I alluded to at the top slash promised that we would have a field report, a very special field report from a special guest. So last week we talked about Archdruid's Charm. We looked at a bunch of decks in Modern that were playing it, and we heard from David about some shells that you've been playing in Pioneer that use the Archdruid's Charm in like novel ways. Zach Manisimo-Ryle, in between entertaining the masses on Carnival Cruise Lines, orchestrating a killer show every night, I'm told, has also been finding time when his ship comes into port to get some leagues in. So he had a chance to play David's lists, and he even recorded for us a little field report. Let's hear from him.
Dan, I'm coming to you live from the high seas, where I'm regretting not packing my microphone, but hopefully our friends will bear with us out there in the faithless universe. I hope you're all well. Dave, I hope you're doing well. I'm here to report on some leagues that I played with Archdruid's Charm. So, first of all, we played with the Enigmatic Incarnation and In Search of Greatness deck list. Hopefully you guys can walk through exactly what these cards do in particular. But the idea here was that both In Search of Greatness and Enigmatic Incarnation sort of ask for you to build a deck with certain rungs of a ladder, not an entire ladder, but rather certain steps, like 2 to 3 or 4 to 5 or 6 to 7 in this case. Both In Search of Greatness and Enigmatic Incarnation allow you to do things where you have a permanent and then you get to do something with a permanent that has the same mana value +1. In Search of Greatness is a very volatile and difficult card to build and play around, but hopefully Archdruid's Charm here was going to sort of smooth over some of the bumps in that otherwise difficult strategy, and could do so also with Leyline of the Guild Pact. So I went into leagues with this, and I have to say, I did feel some, let's say, confidence against some of the decks I played against, despite the fact that I went 1-4. Certainly out of practice in the world of Pioneer, but we're getting better all the time. My one win was against Phoenix, where I actually won all 3 games, as I've described in the extended notes here. I punted a game where I could have had a Leyline Binding up to not die to a Crackling Drake. But overall, part of the problem in this league was that I ran into Lotus Field twice. And while this deck does have the ability to put out something like a Archon of Emyria in the sideboard games, there's just not a lot of clock. Even at the best of times, your best clock is like an Atraxa. And your style of interaction is usually doesn't line up well against what Lotus Field's doing in particular. Ditto for blue-white. So those 3 felt pretty hopeless. And the red-white heroic player that I played against also just came out very quickly. So that was a little tricky. I had not played against that deck before, and boy, is that a beating. So I have a lot of notes here. Generally speaking, as tutor targets, we had Kutzil's Flanker, Deputy of Detention, Knight of Autumn on the 3s, Elishnorn, Kenrith, Tolsmir, Friend to Wolves on the 5, and Atraxa, and Titan of Industry on the 7. Against blue-white control, I actually got ground out to the point where none of my, like, I ran out of threats. And that was obviously a problem. And against a lot of the other decks, it felt like these 3 drops were generally kind of medium to medium minus. So, I mean, part of the problem that this deck had was just if you do get everything to come together, all you're doing is putting an Atraxa into play, and in a way that's a lot more difficult than a lot of other decks. And then the cards you're drawing into with it sometimes are not so helpful. In Search of Greatness, not yet has found its greatness. So for the moment, it's in search of mediocrity, I suppose. But in terms of greatness, now we have a much more promising deck list, at least in my mind, which is our Devotion of the Guild Pact deck. So Mono Green has had a small resurgence in the leagues, at least, on the back of Leyline of the Guild Pact and some builds that people are trying with that. Leyline of the Guild Pact coming in on turn zero can turbocharge your Nykthos Shrine to Nyx, producing green mana. And this deck was splashing into white for Leyline Binding, and then also playing some Nylea's Presence for redundancy on that tactic, because if you don't have a turn zero Leyline, then your Leyline Bindings would be ostensibly four mana, which is a little bit much. So I played one league with the original build of this deck, went 1-4 as well. Again, in this case, I actually had some very difficult opponents. I played against Phoenix, Red-White Heroic, Amalia Combo, Lotus Field, and a really insane, really cool Squirming Emergence Self-Mill deck. That one was tricky just because they were actually reanimating Ugin's, which ended up causing a loss because we didn't have a great way to deal with that. Leyline Binding, the way it lined up, you still get Wrathed first, which really doesn't put you in a good place. The Amalia combo is able to defend itself with one mana sort of hexproof indestructible sort of spells. Red White Heroic has the same thing going on. So this league was a good learning experience of what the current state of Pioneer is, but encouraged me to go into a second league where I modified the deck list to what is in the pictures here, the picture here. So changing up the tutor targets a little bit, Dave suggested switching into a main deck Scavenging Ooze. That was super useful. Hydroid Crisis is a great card in the grinding matchups right now. And I made the decision to put in a Cityscape Leveler in addition to the Voracious Hydra that's in there to sort of have cards that themselves can fight. The Archdruid's Charm, the fight mode, put a +1/+1 counter and bite, actually. That is one of the most powerful and I think sometimes unexpected modes of that card. Just giving you removal. And certainly, actually, my opponents used that against me out of the Lotus Field deck a couple of times to great benefit to themselves. So my final notes, I mean, this was another 2-3 league, but with a lot of really, really close matches, like against Boros Heroic. The game three was a real heartbreaker where I had a double Leyline Binding to shut down most of their creatures. And I had a really good, I think it was a double Leyline mana engine. Yeah, it's in the notes here. So I had double Leyline and double Leyline Binding. And it bought me a lot of time, and then I just couldn't draw into anything. Same with my match against Black Red Vampires. I lost game one where I played an X-12 Crisis. And I drew five lands and one spell, which immediately got Thought Seized. So there were some really rough breaks in this league that took it from a potential like 4-1 to a 2-3. So the second build of the deck has a lot of promise. I really think so. And so to that end, I have my final impressions written here and some ideas for where you could modify this deck. But I think overall, the conclusion that I took away from this is that adding the Nylea's Presence and Leyline Binding is an awesome, awesome idea. It works as a concept of having this sort of source to plowshares. The problem with that is that Mono Green, this kind of shell that I've played a lot of, in fact, when the deck was kind of breaking out with Karn, I went to the finals of Canada's biggest ever at the time Team Trios tournament playing this deck. And the thing about it then was that it was kind of this like all in super proactive deck. And then it had Karn as a four of course, that gave you a sort of Swiss Army knife of different things you could do. And Archer's Charm allows that deck to do it, to do the same kind of thing now using main deck slots. So I think at the moment, the way this deck works best is without the Nylea's Presence, without the Leyline Binding, and just using those slots on more either Devotion Pips in the early game to make sure your mana engine is going, or big payoff threats. I will say the Hydrid Crisis is probably something those decks should consider more often if they have a reliable way to produce the blue mana. Of course, that's the tricky part. But Hydrid Crisis seemed like a really, really great payoff. I don't think green has the ability to just draw that many cards in volume the same way. Of course, I think the green devotion decks, as they're currently built and being successful right now, are still using the Cavaliers and or the Storm of the Festivals, which I guess in combination sort of serve the same purpose of allowing you to churn through your deck as long as you have a huge amount of mana. So hopefully some of this stuff is useful for you folks. There's some spectacular screenshots, and I had a lot of fun games, a lot of fun matches, a lot of interesting interactions. I hope everyone is well. Stay healthy, stay happy, and I'll see you soon.
Okay, so David, basically Zach is saying that he likes the concepts. The win-loss record was not so great for either deck. That's not the sole determining factor, right? We focus on the positives, but what do you make of this, David?
Yeah, I had somewhat similar results. So I had a similar result when I played a league of In Search of Greatness. The deck does really have very clunky draws. You're playing a lot more do-nothings than a normal deck. You don't have good one-drops without your ley line. And that tension, right? You're only trying to play a couple 3-drops that are tutorable, a couple 5-drops, and a couple 7s. And if those cards aren't enough to win, you can't win. If you don't draw the cards in the right order, you can't win, etc. So I totally agree with that. I think In Search for Greatness continues to be the the white whale for Hellsake, I Spit at Thee, etc. I did play a league of the sort of domain list and had a bit more success than Zach. I played Vampires 4 times, I think, and went 3-1, and then lost a close match to Phoenix.
About 4 times against Vampires? What the heck?
Well, you know, people don't like to brew. They just like to play whatever was just a popular deck. So their Archduke Charm felt awesome. He tweaked some of the creatures versus what I had. I'm basically off Elish Norn. It doesn't match up very well with anything. But yeah, I'm open to the idea of cutting white. It's something that Rhett, who's a friend of the podcast, and I discussed, is like, once you cut Elish Norn, then Leyline Binding gets worse, the Nylea's Presences get worse. Could you just maybe splash blue? The other thing I was thinking of, if you wanted to get super creative, you could play like Karn at Home with the blue fairy with adventure.
What's Karn at Home?
So the blue fairy that is 3 and a blue, look into your sideboard, get a non-creature card.
Oh, Fae of Wishes.
You could get rid of the white splash. You could play like a couple of those, and you could play like both Zach and I really loved Hydroid Crisis. It's very well positioned.
Yeah.
The fairy's tutorable with Archdruid's Charm. So like you really can, in like certain cases and certain matchups, like tutor for the right card, almost as if it was Karn. It just costs a lot more mana. That's at least an avenue I'd at least look into exploring.
That makes sense. So overall, it seems like we haven't quite found the winning formula yet. But, well, that in itself is interesting because you put up great results when you were told about these decks last week. But that was before you took it into leagues.
Yeah, and I tried to really couch the results by describing, you know, it is Arena. I was just really unimpressed by the level of play there. And this is not just like Grognardian, right? Like, I think I was, between Rhett and myself playing, I think we're like 12-2 or 14-3 or something with the Leyline list. And I think I went 3-2 in my league. And, you know, Zach went 2-3 or something, which felt like a little bit more real. Now, of course, it's a deck with a lot of variance because Leyline of the Guild Pack is a terribly designed card. And Nykthos is also a terribly designed card. So when you draw some of those cards together, right, the deck is very powerful. When you draw them, when Leyline is your 8th card, it's a very poor card. So there, of course, there's inherent variability. But I also just, like, in general, am never going to report any results from Arena again. I just think the level of play there is terrible. Some people lose game 1 and just quit. There's, like, questionable plays all over. It feels like I could win based on whichever side I'm playing from. So Yeah, so it's worth noting, right? It's like music. If you're just listening it for free on Spotify, it just literally cannot mean as much to you as if you had to like drive to Best Buy, middle-aged people who might be listening, and purchase a CD with money. You just care about the music a lot more than if it's just wallpaper in your room, and that's what Arena is.
So I thought you were trying to draw a contrast between free Spotify and Spotify Premium, and I'm like, yeah, I guess I enjoy the music more on Spotify Premium.
No, Spotify. Don't talk to me about Spotify. If I talk to someone who says they're a big fan of music and then talks about a Spotify playlist, it's like, oh, you're exactly the problem. You don't like music. You don't like musicians. You don't really like art, and you're probably a bad person. So that's the end of it. Arena free to play is awesome, but the fact that people are just there, like, I don't know, they're probably doing something else, right? They're probably watching an excellent new show on Netflix or something at the same time. I don't know what they're doing, but you're just getting wins you don't deserve. So it's really good that MTGO exists, where people actually have to have some skin in the game, and we can actually play real Magic.
Yeah, they're probably playing Arena while tweaking their Spotify playlists. So
exactly.
Yeah, you're not going to find quality competition there.
So maybe at the super top end of Mythic, you can, right? And maybe we just have to like rank all the way up to there so we can like try decklists out. But
yeah,
then again, if you're losing with your new brews, you're going to quickly leave the top end of Mythic. So
I know that many of our listeners do play in Arena. And just to clarify, we're not talking about you. If you listen to podcasts, if you're engaged enough that you've made it this deep into this episode of this cast, you are not the kind of people David is talking about. Arena just has a huge player base. The vastness of the player base on the ladder means you're just not going to find that great of a match on average.
And again, I suspect these people are doing multiple things at once. I maybe they're all excellent players, but it's like, you know, if you're doing that and you're, you know, sitting at the office doing work or whatever, I think that's more about what it is too. Because the interface, to its credit, is so frictionless, I think people are just often doing it while they're doing other stuff.
We mean while you're on the toilet. That's essentially what we're talking about. Hey. But being at work.
I mean, I have a buddy. He's married. His wife is just gave birth, and he's just like, yeah, I get like 20 minutes a night. And it is him. Like, he's not actually going to the bathroom, but he's telling his wife that's what he's doing. So he just like gets a quick draft in or something. Those are the people you can rinse with this deck. Trust me. Mom starts calling, and it's go time. You got to get out of that game too.
Oh dear. All right. Well, on that note, it would take several trips to the bathroom to make it through this episode, but we appreciate that you stuck with us. We will keep tinkering, keep searching for greatness, trying to get that elusive 4-1 or maybe even 5-0 someday. But yeah, in the meantime, we have plenty of stuff to tinker with. These deduce lists, these clue lists look really fun, really sweet. I will be hopefully playing some Paper Magic this weekend, and I will let you all know how that went next time.
All right, until then, take care.
All right, see you later, David.